Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
But first, on this Memorial Day, where we acknowledge men and women who've made the ultimate sacrifice for their country, we thought we'd like to talk about what it's like to be a member of one of this country's most elite fighting units. They are the Navy SEALs, known to Americans if only by reputation for their participation in some of the most dangerous and important missions, like the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound. It turns out, though, that not all their missions are covert. For the past few years, members of the group have been traveling to the country's schools and recreation centers to promote physical fitness and mental toughness, and to give young people a taste of what it's like to be a SEAL. We wanted to talk more about that, so with us is Scott Williams. He is a retired Navy Senior Chief. He is now Marketing Director of the Navy SEAL Scout Team. Also with us is Senior Chief Joseph Jones. He's an active duty Navy SEAL who served for more than a decade in the Special Forces. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Michelle, for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Senior Chief Jones, the training, the process of becoming a SEAL is known for being particularly grueling. Having gone through it yourself, does it live up to the billing?
Oh, yes, it does. Making it through SEAL training was probably, Mark, one of the greatest moments of my life, and I was told it was the toughest military training in the world, and going through Hell Week proved that it definitely was.
What is it that you like about it, or what is it that you were looking for in self-selecting for the experience, as Mr. Williams was telling us?
Yes, right. Each person's a little different. I was already in the Navy. I've got 24 years in the Navy, around the nine-year mark. I was at an impressionable age, just like a lot of these young men are, and I was looking for something different to do. And I met a SEAL, and he told me about the program, and that inspired me. He planted a seed, and it just grew from there, and I self-selected at that moment to do something different and to be all that I can be for my country.
Do you mind if I point out that you also happen to be African-American? I happen to look at some of the institutions where these physical fitness challenges and where the SEALs have gone have been diverse institutions. I'm wondering, what's it like when you show up? Are people surprised to see you there?
Oh, yes. Regardless of whether it's a predominantly white audience or mixed audience or African-American, they're all kind of like shocked, because we are, like, out of 2,500 SEALs, there's only like 50 of us. And it's very rare that you see a black face. People are always a little shocked, and African-Americans are very impressed usually, and kind of excited and more respondent to you, because they see that, hey, that guy's just like me.
Why do you think that is?
I'm glad you asked that, and it's something I address almost every diverse audience that I speak to, and because I get that question a lot, and it's not racism. It's not racism. It's not because of anything other than two things that I've seen from a personal experience talking to other friends and family. And it's one is awareness. You can't aspire to be something that you have no idea. You truly don't know what it is. And the other thing is swimming. A lot of African Americans, especially ones that I know personally, don't know how to swim or not comfortable in the water. And obviously, being a U.S. Navy SEAL, you have to be very proficient in the water.
Because SEAL stands for what?
Sea, air, and land. It's a big part of the sea.
Scott Williams, do you have anything to add to that point about what Senior Chief was telling us, Senior Chief Jones was telling us about this, the relative lack of diversity compared to other branches of the service? You think it's the swimming?
Well, certainly that's a factor, and I think Joe touched upon an important point, and that is that, you know, we value diversity in our organization, and in the past we've kind of done a poor job of communicating to diverse audiences that we want them to. I tend to look at it more from an organizational perspective, and the more variety that we have in the organization, the stronger we're going to be, and we always want to be the strongest possible organization.
The CALS, Context of White Supremacy, Gusty Renegade Justice, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, January 23rd, 2015, so I have been told. shout to Michelle Martin in PR Zone. That was from her broadcast that was just shut down last summer, Tell Me More. I was a fan, or I am continue to be a fan of Michelle Martin, and I really enjoy Tell Me More. They talked quite a bit about racism, the segment that they aired way back in 2012. I thought some interesting additional information, given the text that we are reading. American sniper Chris Kyle, allegedly his autobiography, it has been one of the dominant news items of 2015. It just set the box office record, racked up over $120 million in its first full release weekend. Just this past weekend, one of the billboards in Southern California was tagged with the words murder in big red letters. Obviously, the Oscar controversy with it and the film Selma just has been a lot of dialogue. I hope folks are getting some constructive information from the text. We will be starting. We are in Chapter 8, subheading Marcus. For me, it is on page 373. With that, we will go ahead and get started. Feel free to chime in. We'll give out the number once the first audio segment concludes. American sniper Chris Kyle, context of white supremacy.
Marcus. The 4th of July 2005 was a beautiful California day. Perfect weather, not a cloud in the sky. My wife and I took our son and drove out to a friend's house in the foothills outside of town. There, we spread a blanket and gathered in the tailgate of my Yukon to watch the fireworks put on at an Indian reservation in the valley. It was a perfect spot. We could see down as the fireworks came up to us, and the effect was spectacular. I've always loved celebrating the 4th of July. I love the symbolism, meaning of the day, and of course the fireworks and the barbecues. It's just a wonderful time. But that day, as I sat back and watched the red, white, and blue sparkles, sadness suddenly spread over me. I fell into a deep black hole. This sucks, I muttered as the fireworks exploded. I wasn't critiquing the show. I had just realized that I might never see my friend Marcus Luttrell again. I hated to be unable to do anything to help my friend, who was facing God only knew what kind of trouble. We'd gotten word a few days before that he was missing. I'd also heard through the Seal grapevine that the three guys he was with were dead. They'd been ambushed by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Surrounded by hundreds of Taliban fighters, they fought ferociously. Another 16 men in a rescue party were killed when the Chinook they were flying in was shot down. You can and should read the details in Marcus's book, Lone Survivor. To that point, losing a friend in combat seemed, if not impossible, at least distant and unlikely. It may seem strange to say, given everything I'd been through, but at that point we were feeling pretty sure of ourselves. Cocky, maybe. You just get to a point where you think you're such a superior fighter that you can't be hurt. Our platoon had come through the war without any serious injuries. In some respects, training seemed more dangerous. There had been accidents in training. Not long before, we were doing ship takedowns when one of our platoon members fell while going up the side. He landed on two other guys in the boat. All three had to go to the hospital. One of the men he landed on broke his neck. We don't focus on the dangers. The families, though, are a different story. They're always very aware of the dangers. The wives and girlfriends often take turns sitting in the hospital with the families of people who were injured. Inevitably, they realize they could be sitting there for their own husband or boyfriend. I remained torn up about Marcus for the rest of the night in my own private black hole. I stayed there for a few days. Work, of course, continued. One day, my chief popped his head into the room and signaled me to join him outside. "Hey, they found Marcus," he said as soon as we were alone. "Great." "He's fucked up." "So what? He's going to make it." Anyone who knew Marcus knew that was true. The man cannot be kept down. "Yeah, you're right," said my chief. "But he's pretty tore up, beat up. It'll be hard." It was hard, but Marcus was up to it. In fact, despite health issues that continued to dog him, he would deploy again not long after leaving the hospital. Expert, so-called. Because of what I'd done in Fallujah, I was pulled out a few times to talk to headshed types about how I thought snipers should be deployed. I was now a subject matter expert, an SME in militaries. I hated it. Some people might find it flattering to be talking to a bunch of high-ranking officers, but I just wanted to do my job. It was torture sitting in the room, trying to explain what the war was like. They'd ask me questions like, what kind of gear should we have? Not unreasonable, I guess, but all I could think of was, God, you guys are really all pretty stupid. This is basic stuff you should have figured out long ago. I would tell them what I thought, how we should train up snipers, how we should use them. I suggested more training about urban overwatches and creating hides in buildings, things that I'd learned more or less as I went. I gave them ideas about sending snipers into an area before the assault so they could provide intel to the assault teams before they arrived. I made suggestions on how to make snipers more active and aggressive. I suggested that snipers take shots over the heads of an assault team during training so the teams could get used to working with them. I told the brass about gear issues, the dust cover of the M11, for example, and suppressors that jiggled at the end of the barrel, hurting the accuracy of the rifle. It was all extremely obvious to me, but not to them. Asked for my opinion, I'd give it, but most times they didn't really want it. They wanted me to validate some decision they'd already made or some thought they'd already had. I'd tell them about a given piece of gear I thought we should have. They'd answer that they'd already bought 1,000 of something else. I'd offer them a strategy I'd used successfully in Fallujah. They'd quote me chapter and verse on why it wouldn't work. Taya. We had a lot of confrontations while he was home. His enlistment was coming up, and I didn't want him to re-up. I felt he had done his duty to the country, even more than anyone could ask, and I felt that we needed him. I've always believed that your responsibility is to God, family, and country, in that order. He disagreed. He put country ahead of family. And yet, he wasn't completely obstinate. He always said, if you tell me not to re-enlist, I won't. But I couldn't do that. I told him, I can't tell you what to do. You'll just hate me and resent me all your life. But I will tell you this, I said. If you do re-enlist, then I know exactly where we stand. It will change things. I won't want it to, but I know in my heart it will. When he re-enlisted anyway, I thought, okay, now I know. Being a SEAL is more important to him than being a father or a husband. New guys. While we were training up for our next deployment, the platoon got a group of new guys. A few of them stood out, Dauber and Tommy, for example, who were both snipers and corpsmen. But I think the new guy who made the biggest impression was Ryan Job, and the reason was that he did not look like a SEAL. On the contrary, Ryan looked like a big lump. I was floored that they let this guy come to the team. Here we all were, buff, in great shape. And here was a round, soft-looking guy. I went up to Ryan and got in his face. What's your problem, fat fuck? You think you're a SEAL? We all gave him shit. One of my officers, we'll call him LT, knew him from buds and stuck up for him, but LT was a new guy himself, so that didn't carry too much weight. Being a new guy, we would have beat Ryan's ass anyway, but his weight made things a lot worse for him. We actively tried to make him quit. But Ryan wasn't a quitter. You couldn't compare his determination with anyone else's. That kid started working out like a maniac. He lost weight and got into better shape. More importantly, anything we told him to do, he did. He was such a hard worker, so sincere, and so damn funny, that at some point we just went, I love you. You are the man. Because no matter how he looked, he truly was a SEAL. And a damn good one. We tested him, believe me. We'd find the biggest man in the platoon and make him carry him. He did it. We'd have him take the hardest jobs in training. He did them without complaint, and he'd crack us up in the process. He had these great facial expressions, He could point his upper lip, screw his eyes around, and then twist in a certain way, and you'd lose it. Naturally, this ability led to a certain amount of fun, for us at least. One time we told him to go do the face to our chief.
"But,"
he stammered. "Do it," I told him. "Go get in his face. You're the new guy. Do it." He did. Thinking Ryan was trying to be a jerk, the chief grabbed him by the throat and tossed him to the ground. That only encouraged us. Ryan had to show the face a lot. Every time he'd go and get his ass beat. Finally, we had him do it to one of our officers. A huge guy. Definitely not someone to be messed with, even by another SEAL. "Go do it to him," one of us said. "Oh, God, no," he protested. "If you don't do it right now, we're going to choke you out," I warned. "Can you please just choke me out right now?" "Go do it," we all said. He went and did it to the officer. He reacted about how you would expect. After a while, Ryan tried to tap out. "There's no tapping out," he snarled, continuing his pounding. Ryan survived, but that was the last time we made him do the face. Everybody got hazed when they joined the platoon. We were equal opportunity ball busters. Officers got it just as bad as enlisted men. At the time, new guys didn't receive their tridents, and thus weren't really SEALs, until after they had passed a series of tests with the team. We had our own little ritual that involved a mock boxing match against their whole platoon. Each new guy had to go through 3 rounds. Once you're knocked down, that's a round, before being formally pinned and welcomed to the Brotherhood. I was Ryan's safety officer, making sure he didn't get too busted up. He had a head guard and everyone wore boxing gloves, but the hazing can get kind of enthusiastic, and the safety officer is there to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. Ryan wasn't satisfied with 3 rounds. He wanted more. I think he thought if he fought long enough, he'd beat them all. Not that he lasted too much longer. I had warned him that I was his safety, and whatever he did, he was not to hit me. In the confusion of his head being bounced off the platoon's gloves, he swung and hit me. I did what I had to do. Mark Lee. With our deployment rapidly approaching, our platoon was beefed up. Command brought a young SEAL named Mark Lee over from another unit to help round us out. He immediately fit in. Mark was an athletic guy, in some ways exactly the sort of tough physical specimen you'd expect to be a SEAL. Before joining the Navy, he had played soccer well enough to be given a tryout with a professional team, and may very well have been pro if a leg injury hadn't cut his career short. But there was a lot more to Mark than just physical prowess. He'd studied for the ministry, and while he left because of what he saw as hypocrisy among the seminary students, he was still very religious. Later on, during our deployment, he led a small group in prayer before every op. As you'd expect, he was very knowledgeable about the Bible and religion in general. He didn't push it on you, but if you needed or wanted to talk about faith or God, he was always willing. Not that he was a saint, or even above the horseplay that is part of being a SEAL. Soon after he joined us, we went on a training mission to Nevada. At the end of the day, a group of us piled into a 4-door truck and headed back to the base to get to bed. Mark was in the back with me and a SEAL we'll call Bob. For some reason, Bob and I started talking about being choked out. With new guy enthusiasm, and maybe naivete, Mark said, "I've never been choked out." "Excuse me," I said, leaning over to get a look at this virgin. "Being choked out is a mandatory SEAL occupation." Mark looked at me. I looked at him. "Bring it on," he said. As Bob leaned over, I dove and choked Mark out. My work completed, I leaned back. "You mother," said Bob, straightening. "I wanted to do it." "I thought you were leaning over to let me get him," I told him. "Hell no, I was just handing my watch up front so it wouldn't get broken." "Well, okay," I said. "He'll wake up, then you get him." He did. I think half the platoon had a shot at him before the night was out. Mark took it well. Of course, as a new guy, he had no choice. Command. I loved our new CO. He was outstanding, aggressive, and stayed out of our hair. He not only knew each one of us by name and face, he knew our wives and girlfriends. He took it personally when he lost people, and yet was able to stay aggressive at the same time. He never held us back in training, and, in fact, approved extra training for snipers. My command master chief, whom I'll call Primo, was another top-notch commander. He didn't give a flying fuck about promotions, about looking good or covering his butt. He was all about successful missions and getting the job done. And he was a Texan. As you can tell, I'm a little partial, which meant he was a badass. His briefings always started the same way. "What are you sons of bitches doing?" he'd snarl. "Are you going to get out there and kick some ass?" Primo was all about getting into battle. He knew what SEALs are supposed to do, and he wanted us to do it. He was also a good old boy off the battlefield. You always have team guys getting in trouble during off time and training. Bar fights are a big problem. I remember him pulling us aside when he came on. "Listen, I know you're going to get into fights," he told us, "so here's what you do. You hit fast, you hit hard, and you run. If you don't get caught, I don't care, because when you get caught is when I have to get involved." I took that advice to heart, though it wasn't always possible to follow. Maybe because he was from Texas, or maybe because he had the soul of a brawler himself, he took a liking to me and another Texan, whom we called Pepper. We became his golden boys. He'd cover our asses when we got in trouble. There were times when I may have told off an officer or two. Chief Primo took care of it. He might chew me out himself, but he always smoothed the way with head shed. On the other side of things, he knew he could count on Pepper and me to get a job done if it needed doing. Tats. While I was home, I had a pair of new tattoos added to my arm. One was a trident. Now that I felt like a real SEAL, I felt I had earned it. I had it put on the inside of my arm where not everyone would see, but I knew it was there. I didn't want it to be out there bragging. On the front of my arm, I had a Crusader cross inked in. I wanted everyone to know I was a Christian. I had it put in red for blood. I hated the damn savages I'd been fighting. I always will. They've taken so much from me. Even the tattoos became a cause for stress between my wife and myself. She didn't like tattoos in general, and the way I got these, staying out late one evening when she was expecting me home, surprising her with them, added to our friction. Taya saw it as one more sign that I was changing, becoming somebody she didn't know. I didn't think of it that way at all, though I admit I knew she wouldn't like it. But it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. Actually, I had wanted full sleeves, so in my mind it was a compromise. Getting ready to go. While I was home, Taya became pregnant with our second child. Again, that was a lot of strain for my wife. My father told Taya that he was sure once I saw my son and spent time with him, I wouldn't want to re-enlist or go back to war. But while we talked a lot about it, in the end, I didn't feel there was much of a question about what to do. I was a SEAL. I was trained for war. I was made for it. My country was at war, and it needed me. And I missed it. I missed the excitement and the thrill. I loved killing bad guys. "If you die, it will wreck all our lives," Taya told me. "It pisses me off you would not only risk your life, but risk ours, too." For the moment, we agreed to disagree. As it came up to the time to deploy, our relationship became more distant. Taya would push me away emotionally, as if she were putting on armor for the coming months. I may have done the same thing. "It's not intentional," she told me, in one of the rare moments when we both could realize what was happening and actually talk about it. We still loved each other. It may sound strange. We were close and not close, needing each other and yet needing distance between us, needing to do other things, at least in my case. I was anticipating leaving. I was excited about doing my job again. Giving birth. A few days before we were scheduled to deploy, I went to the doctor to see about getting a cyst in my neck removed. Inside his examining room, he numbed the area around it with the local anesthesia. Then they stuck a needle in my neck to suction the material out. I think. I don't actually know, because as soon as the needle went in, I passed out with a seizure. When I came to, I was out flat on the examining table. My feet were where my head should have been. I had no other ill effects, not from the seizure or the procedure. No one really could figure out why I'd reacted the way I did. As far as anyone could tell, I was fine. But there was a problem. A seizure is grounds for being medically discharged from the Navy. Luckily, there was a corpsman whom I'd served with in the room. He persuaded the doctor not to include the seizure in his report, or to write what happened in a way that wouldn't affect my deployment or my career. I'm not sure which. I never heard anything about it again. But what the seizure did do was keep me from getting to Taya. While I'd been passing out, she had been having a routine pregnancy checkup. It was about 3 weeks before our daughter was due, and days before I was supposed to deploy. The checkup included an ultrasound, and when the technician looked away from the screen, my wife realized something was wrong. "I have a feeling you're having this baby right away," was the most the technician would say before getting up and fetching the doctor. The baby had her umbilical cord around her neck. She was also breached, and the amount of amniotic fluid, liquid that nourishes and protects the developing infant, was low. "We'll do a C-section," said the doc. "Don't worry, we'll get this baby out tomorrow. You'll be fine." Taya had called me several times. By the time I came to, she was already at the hospital. We spent a nervous night together. The next morning, the doctors performed a C-section. As they were working, they hit some kind of artery and splashed blood all over the place. I was deathly afraid for my wife. I felt real fear. Worse. Maybe it was a touch of what she'd gone through every moment of my deployment. It was a terrible hopelessness and despair. A hard thing to admit, let alone stomach. Our daughter was fine. I took her and held her. I'd been as distant toward her as I'd been toward our son before he was born. Now, holding her, I started to feel real warmth and love. Taya looked at me strangely when I tried to hand her the baby. "Don't you want to hold her?" I asked. "No," she said. "God," I thought, "she's rejecting our daughter. I have to leave, and she's not even bonding." A few moments later, Taya reached out and took her. Thank God. 2 days later, I deployed. 9. The Punishers. I'm here to get those mortars. You would think an army planning a major offensive would have a way to get its warriors right to the battle area. You would think wrong. Because of the medical situation with the cyst and then my daughter's birth, I ended up leaving the States about a week behind the rest of my platoon. By the time I landed in Baghdad in April 2006, my platoon had been sent west to the area of Ramadi. No one in Baghdad seemed to know how to get me out there. It was up to me to get over to my boys. A direct flight to Ramadi was impossible. Things were too hot there. So I had to cobble together my own solution. I came across an Army Ranger who was also heading for Ramadi. We hooked up, pooling our creative resources as we looked for a ride at Baghdad International Airport. At some point, I overheard an officer talking about problems the Army was having with some insurgent mortarmen at a base to the west. By coincidence, we heard about a flight heading to that same base. The Ranger and I headed over to try and get onto the helicopter. A colonel stopped us as we were about to board. "Helicopter's full," he barked at the Ranger. "Why do you need to be on it?" "Well, sir, we're the snipers coming to take care of your mortar problem," I told him, holding up my gun case. "Oh, yes," the colonel yelled to the crew. "These boys need to be on the very next flight. Get them right on." We hopped aboard, bumping two of his guys in the process. By the time we got to the base, the mortars had been taken care of. We still had a problem, though. There were no flights heading for Ramadi, and the prospects of a convoy were slimmer than the chance of seeing snow in Dallas in July. But I had an idea. I led the Ranger to the base hospital and found a corpsman. I've worked with the number as a SEAL, and in my experience, the Navy medics always know their way around problems. I took a sealed challenge coin out of my pocket and slipped it into my hand, exchanging it when we shook. Challenge coins are special tokens that are created to honor members of a unit for bravery or other special achievements. A sealed challenge coin is especially valued, both for its rarity and symbolism. Slipping it to someone in the Navy is like giving him a secret handshake. Listen, I told the corpsman, I need a serious favor. I'm a SEAL sniper. My unit is in Ramadi. I gotta get there, and he's coming with me. I gestured to the ranger. Okay, said the corpsman, his voice almost a whisper. Come into my office. We went into his office. He took out a rubber stamp, inked our hands, then wrote something next to the mark. It was a triage code. The corpsman medevaced us into Ramadi. We were the first and probably only people to be medevaced into a battle rather than out of it. And I thought only SEALs could be that creative. I have no idea why that worked, but it did. No one on the chopper we were hustled into questioned the direction of our flight, let alone the nature of our wounds. Shark Base. Ramadi was in Al-Anbar, the same province as Fallujah, about 30 miles farther west. Many of the insurgents who'd been run out of Fallujah were said to have holed up there. There was plenty of evidence. Attacks had ratcheted up ever since Fallujah had been pacified. By 2006, Ramadi was considered the most dangerous city in Iraq. A hell of a distinction. My platoon had been sent to Camp Ramadi, a U.S. base along the Euphrates River outside the city. Our compound, named Shark Base, had been set up by an earlier task unit and was just outside the wire of Camp Ramadi. When I finally arrived, my boys had been sent to work east of Ramadi. Arranging transportation through the city was impossible. I was pissed. I thought I'd gotten there too late to join in the action. Looking for something to do until I could figure out how to get with the rest of the platoon, I asked my command if I could sit out on the guard towers. Insurgents had been testing the perimeters, sneaking as close as they dared and spraying the base with their AKs. Sure, go ahead, they told me. I went out and took my sniper rifle. Almost as soon as I got into position, I saw two guys skirting around in the distance, looking for a spot to shoot from. I waited until they popped up behind cover. Bang! I got the first one. His friend turned around and started to run. Bang! Got him, too. Seven Story. I was still waiting for a chance to join the rest of my platoon when the Marine unit at the northern end of the city put in a request for snipers to help with an overwatch from a seven-story building near their outpost. The head shed asked me to come up with a team. There were only two other snipers at the base. One was recovering from wounds and looped out on morphine. The other was a chief who appeared reluctant to go. I asked for the guy who was on morphine. I got the chief. We found two 60 gunners, including Ryan Job, to provide a little muscle, and with an officer, headed out to help the Marines. Seven Story was a tall, battered building about 200 yards outside the Marine outpost. Made of tan-colored cement and located near what had been a major road before the war, it looked almost like a modern office building. Or would have if it weren't for the missing windows and huge holes where it had been hit by rockets and shells. It was the tallest thing around, and had a perfect vantage into the city. We went out in early evening with several Marines and local Jundis for security. The Jundis were loyal Iraqi militia or soldiers who were being trained. There were a number of different groups, each with its own level of expertise and efficiency, or most often, the opposite of both. While there was still light, we got a few shots here and there, all on isolated insurgents. The area around the building was pretty run down. A whitewashed wall with a fancy iron gate separating one sand-strewn empty lot from another. Night fell, and suddenly we were in the middle of a flood of bad guys. They were on their way to assault the Marine outpost, and we just happened to be along the route. There were a ton of them. At first, they didn't realize we were there. And it was open season. Then I saw three guys with RPGs taking aim at us from about a block away. I shot each of them in succession, saving us the hassle of ducking from their grenades. The firefight quickly shifted our way. The Marines called us over the radio and told us to collapse back to them. Their outpost was a few hundred treacherous yards away. While one of the 60 gunners, my officer, and I provided cover, the rest of our group went downstairs and moved over to the Marine base. Things got hot so fast that by the time they were clear, we were surrounded. We stayed where we were. Ryan realized our predicament as soon as he arrived at the Marine outpost. He and the chief got into an argument over whether to provide cover for us. The chief claimed that their job was to stay with the Iraqi Jundis, who were already hunkered down inside the Marine camp. The chief ordered him to stay. Ryan told him what he could do with that order. Ryan ran upstairs on the roof of the Marine building, where he joined the Marines trying to lay down support fire for us as we fought off the insurgents. The Marines sent a patrol over to pull us out. As I watched them coming from the post, I spotted an insurgent moving in behind him. I fired once. The Marine patrol hit the dirt. So did the Iraqi, though he didn't get up. "There's an insurgent sniper out there, and he's good," their radio man called. "He nearly got us." I got on my radio. "That's me, dumbass. Look behind you." They turned around and saw a savage with a rocket launcher lying dead on the ground. "God, thank you," answered the Marine. "Don't mention it." The Iraqis did have snipers working that night. I got two of them, one who was up on the minaret of a mosque and another on a nearby building. This was a fairly well-coordinated fight, one of the better organized ones we would encounter in the area. It was unusual because it took place at night. The bad guys generally didn't try and press their luck in the dark. Finally, the sun came up and the gunfire slacked down. The Marines pulled out a bunch of armored vehicles to cover for us, and we ran back to their camp. I went up to see their commander and brief him on what had happened. I had barely gotten a sentence out of my mouth when a burly Marine officer burst into the office. "Who the hell was the sniper up there on 7th story? He barked. I turned around and told him it was me, bracing myself to be chewed out for some unknown offense. "I want to shake your hand, son," he said, pulling off his glove. "You saved my life." He was the guy I'd called the dumbass on the radio earlier. I've never seen a more grateful Marine. The legend. My boys returned from their adventures out east soon afterward. They greeted me with their usual warmth. "Oh, we know the legend's here," they said as soon as they saw me. "All of a sudden we hear there's 2 kills at Camp Ramadi. People are dying up north. We knew the legend was here. You're the only motherfucker who's ever killed anyone out there." I laughed. The nickname The Legend had started back in Fallujah around the time of the beach ball incident, or maybe when I got that really long shot. Before that, my nickname had been Tex. Of course, it wasn't just legend. There was more than a little mocking that went with it. The legend. One of my guys, Dauber, I think it was, even turned it all around and called me the myth, cutting me down to size. It was all good-natured. In a way, more of an honor than a full uniform medal ceremony. I really liked Dauber. Even though he was a new guy, he was a sniper, and a pretty good one. He could hold his own in a firefight, and trading insults. I had a real soft spot for him, and when it came time to haze him, I didn't hit him. Much. Even if the guys joked about it, Legend was one of the better nicknames you could get. Take Dauber. That's not his real name. At the moment, he's doing what we call government work. The nickname came from a character in the television series Coach. There, Dauber was the typical dumb jock type. In real life, he's actually an intelligent guy, but that fact was of no consideration in his getting named. But one of the best nicknames was Ryan Jobes, Biggles. It was a big, goofy name for a big, goofy guy. Dauber takes credit for it. The word, he claims, was a combination of big and giggles that had been invented for one of his relatives. He mentioned it one day, applying it to Ryan. Someone else on the team used it, and within seconds, it had stuck. Biggles. Ryan hated it, naturally, which certainly helped it stick. Along the way, someone later found a little purple hippo. Of course, it had to go to the guy who had the hippo face, and Ryan became Biggles the Desert Hippo. Ryan, being Ryan, he turned it all around. It wasn't a joke on him, it was his joke. Biggles the Desert Hippo, the best 60 gunner on the planet. He carried that hippo everywhere, even into battle. You just had to love the guy. The Punishers. Our platoon had its own nickname, one that went beyond Cadillac. We called ourselves the Punishers. For those of you who are not familiar with the character, the Punisher debuted in a Marvel comic book series in the 1970s. He's a real badass who rights wrongs, delivering vigilante justice. A movie by the same name had just come out. The Punisher wore a shirt with a stylized white skull. Our comms guy suggested it before the deployment. We all thought what the Punisher did was cool. He righted wrongs. He killed bad guys. He made wrongdoers fear him. That's what we were all about. So we adapted his symbol, a skull, and made it our own with some modifications. We spray-painted it on our Hummers and body armor and our helmets and all our guns. And we spray-painted it on every building or wall we could. We wanted people to know, we're here and we want to fuck with you. It was our version of PsyOps. You see us? We're the people kicking your ass. Fear us, because we will kill you, motherfucker. You are bad. We are badder. We are badass. Our sister platoon wanted to use the template we used to mark our gear, but we wouldn't let them. We told them we were the Punishers. They had to get their own symbol. We went a bit light with our Hummers. They were named mostly for G.I. Joe characters like Duke and Snake Eyes. Just because war is hell doesn't mean you can't have a little fun. We had a good team that deployment, starting at the top, decent officers, and a really excellent chief named Tony. Tony had trained as a sniper. He was not only badass, he was an old badass, at least for a SEAL. Rumor has it he was 40 that deployment. SEALs usually do not make it to 40 and stay out in the field. We're too beat up, but Tony somehow managed it. He was a hardcore son of a bitch, and we would have followed him to hell and back. I was the point man, snipers usually are, when we went on patrols. Tony was almost always right behind me. Generally, the chief will be toward the rear of the formation, covering everybody else's ass. But in this case, our LT reasoned that having two snipers at the head of the platoon was more effective. One night soon after the entire platoon had gotten back together, we traveled about 17 kilometers east of Ramadi. The area was green and fertile, so much so that it looked to us like the Vietnamese jungle compared to the desert we'd been operating in. We called it Viet Rom. One night, not long after the unit reunited, we were deposited at a patrol area and began walking toward a suspected insurgent stronghold on foot. Eventually, we came to a huge ditch with the bridge going across it. Most of the time, these bridges were booby-trapped, and in this case, we had intel indicating this one definitely was. So I went up and stood there, shining my laser to look for tripwire. I played the light across the top of the bridge, but saw nothing. I ducked a little lower and tried again. Still nothing. I looked everywhere I could think of, but found no contact wires, no IEDs, no booby traps, nothing. But since I'd been told the bridge was booby-trapped, I was sure there had to be something there. I looked again. My EOD, the bomb disposal expert, was waiting behind me. All I had to do was find a tripwire or the bomb itself, and he'd have it disarmed in seconds. But I couldn't find shit. Finally, I told Tony, "Let's go across." Don't get the wrong image. I wasn't charging across that bridge. I had my rifle in one hand and the other parked protectively over my family jewels. That wouldn't have saved my life if an IED exploded, but at least I'd be intact for the funeral. The bridge was all at 10 feet long, but it must have taken me an hour to get across that thing. When I finally reached the other side, I was soaking wet from sweat. I turned around to give the other guys a thumbs up, but there was no one there. They'd all ducked behind some rocks and brush, waiting for me to blow up. Even Tony, who as point man should have been right behind me. "Motherfucker," I yelled, "where the hell did you go?" "There's no reason for more than one of us to get blown up," he told me matter-of-factly as he came across. Terps. Fallujah had been taken in an all-out assault, moving through the city in a very organized fashion. While it had been successful, the attack had also caused a lot of damage, which had supposedly hurt support for the new Iraqi government. You can argue whether that's true or not. I sure would. But the top American command didn't want the same thing to happen in Ramadi. So while the army worked on a plan for taking Ramadi with minimal destruction, we went to war in the area nearby. We started with DAs. We had four interpreters, Terps as we called them, who helped us deal with the locals. At least one, and usually two, would go out with us. One Terp we really liked was Moose. He was a badass. He'd been working since the invasion in 2003. He was Jordanian, and he was the only one of the Terps we gave a gun. We knew he would fight. He wanted to be an American so bad he would have died for it. Every time we got contacted, he would be out there shooting. He wasn't a great shot, but he could keep the enemy's heads down. Most importantly, he knew when he could and couldn't shoot. Not as easy a call as it might seem. There was this little village outside Shark Base we called Gay Tway. It was infested with insurgents. We would open the gates, walk out, and hit our target. There was one house we went to three or four times. After the first time, they didn't even bother putting the door back. Why they kept going back to that house, I don't know, but we kept going back too. We got to know the place pretty well. It didn't take too long before we started getting a lot of contact in Gay Tway in the village of Viet Ram. An Army National Guard unit covered that area, and we started working with them. Targets. Among our first jobs was to help the Army reclaim the area around a hospital along the river in Viet Ram. The four-story concrete building had been started and then abandoned a few years before. The Army wanted to finish it for the Iraqis. Decent medical care was a big need out there. But they couldn't get close to it to do any work, because as soon as they did, they came under fire. So we went to work. Our platoon, 16 guys, teamed up with about 20 soldiers to clear the nearby village of insurgents. Entering the town early one morning, we split up and started taking houses. I was at point, carrying my Mark 12, the first guy in each building. Once the house was secure, I'd go up to the roof, cover the guys on the ground, and look for insurgents, who we expected to attack once they knew we were there. The group leaped frog forward, clearing the area as we went. Unlike in the city, these houses weren't right next to each other, so the process took longer and was more spread out. But soon enough, the terrorists realized where we were and what we were up to, and they put together a little attack from a mosque. Holed up behind its walls, they started raining AK fire at a squad of soldiers on the ground. I was up on one of the roofs when the fight started. Within moments, we started firing everything we had at the bad guys. M4s, M60s, sniper rifles, 40mm grenades, LAW rockets, everything we had. We lit that mosque up. The momentum of the battle quickly shifted in our favor. The soldiers on the ground began maneuvering to assault the mosque, hoping to catch the insurgents before they could slide back into whatever sewer they'd emerged from. We shifted our fire higher, moving our aim above their heads to allow them to get in. Somewhere in the middle of the fight, a piece of hot brass from another gun, probably an M60 machine gun next to me, shot against my leg and landed in my boots next to my ankle. It burned like hell, but I couldn't do anything about it. There were too many bad guys popping up from behind the walls trying to get my people. I was wearing simple hiking boots rather than combat boots. That was my normal style. They were lighter and more comfortable, and ordinarily more than enough to protect my feet. Unfortunately, I hadn't bothered to lace them up very well before the battle, and there was a space between my pants and the boot where the brass happened to fall after it ejected. What had the instructors told me in Buds about not being able to call time out in battle? When things quieted down, I stood up and pulled out the casing. A good wedge of skin came out with it. We secured the mosque, worked through the rest of the village, then called it a day. Different ways of killing. We went on patrols with the Army unit several more times, trying to reduce resistance in the area. The idea was simple, if potentially risky. We'd make ourselves visible, trying to draw fire from the insurgents. Once they showed themselves, we could fire back and kill them, and usually we did. Pushed from the village and the mosque, the insurgents retreated to the hospital. They loved hospital buildings, not only because they were big and usually well-made, and therefore protective, but because they knew we were reluctant to attack hospitals, even after they were taken over by terrorists. It took a while, but the army command finally decided to attack the building. Good, we all told them when we heard the plan. Let's go do it. We set up an overwatch in a house some 200 or 300 yards from the hospital building, across a clear field. As soon as the insurgents saw us, they started letting us have it. One of my guys shot off a Carl Gustav rocket at the top of the building where they were shooting from. The Gustav put a big old hole there. Bodies flew everywhere. The rocket helped take some of the fight out of them, and as resistance weakened, the army punched in and took the building. By the time they reached the grounds, there was almost no resistance. The few people we hadn't killed had run away. It was always hard to tell how many insurgents were opposing us in a battle like that. A small handful could put up a pretty good fight. A dozen men fighting behind cover could hold up a unit advance for quite a while, depending on the circumstances. Once the insurgents were met with a lot of force, however, you could count on about half squirting out the back or wherever to get away. We had the Carl Gustav with us earlier, but as far as I know, this was the first time we'd actually killed anyone with it, and it may have been the first time any SEAL unit did so. It was certainly the first time we used it against a building. Once word spread, of course, everyone wanted to use them. Technically, the Carl Gustav was developed to combat armor, but as we found out, it was pretty potent against buildings. In fact, it was perfect in Ramadi. It just blew right through reinforced concrete and took out whoever was inside. The overpressure from the explosion wiped out the interior. We had different rounds for the gun. Remember, it's actually considered a recoilless rifle rather than a rocket launcher. A lot of times the insurgents would hide behind embankments and other barriers, well protected. In that case, you could set an airburst round to explode over them. The airburst was a lot worse than anything that detonated on the ground. The Gustav is relatively easy to use. You have to wear double ear protection and be careful where you stood when it's fired, but the results are awesome. Everyone in the platoon wanted to use it after a while. I swear there were fights over who was going to launch it. When you're in a profession where your job is to kill people, you start getting creative about doing it. You think about getting the most firepower you possibly can into the battle, and you start trying to think of new and inventive ways to eliminate your enemy. We had so many targets out in Viet Nam, we started asking ourselves, what weapons have we not used to kill them? No pistols yet? You have to get at least one. We'd use different weapons for the experience to learn the weapon's capabilities in combat. But at times, it was a game. When you're in a firefight every day, you start looking for a little variety. No matter what, there were plenty of insurgents and plenty of firefights. The Gustav turned out to be one of our most effective weapons when we came up against insurgents shooting from buildings. We had LAW rockets, which were lighter and easier to carry, but too many of them turned out to be duds. And once you fired a LAW, you were done. It wasn't a reloadable weapon. The Carl Gustav was always a big hit. Pun intended. Another weapon we used quite a bit was the 40mm grenade launcher. The launcher comes in two varieties, one that attaches under your rifle and another that is a standalone weapon. We had both. Our standard grenade was a frag, a grenade that exploded and sprayed an area with shrapnel or fragments. This is a traditional anti-personnel weapon, tried and true. While we were on this deployment, we received a new type of projectile using a thermobaric explosive. Those had a lot more boom. A single grenade launched at an enemy sniper in a small structure could bring the whole building down because of the overpressure created by the explosion. Most times, of course, we were firing at a larger building, but the destructive power was still intense. You'd have a violent explosion, a fire, and then no more enemy. Gotta love it. You shoot grenades with what we call Kentucky windage, estimating the distance, adjusting the elevation of the launcher, and firing. We liked the M79, the standalone version that was first used during the Vietnam War, because it had sights, making it a bit easier to aim and hit what you wanted. But one way or another, you quickly got the hang of things because you were using the weapon so much. We had contact every time we went out. We loved it. Taya, I had a hard time with the kids after Chris deployed. My mom came and helped me, but it was just a difficult time. I guess I wasn't ready to have another baby. I was mad at Chris, scared for him, and nervous about raising a baby and a toddler all by myself. My son was only a year and a half old. He was getting into everything, and the newborn happened to be really clingy. I remember just sitting on the couch and crying in my bathrobe for days. I would be nursing her and trying to feed him. I'd sit there and cry. The C-section didn't heal well. I had women tell me, after my C-section, I was scrubbing the floors a week later and I was all good. Well, 6 weeks after mine and I was still in pain, still hurting and not healing really well at all. I hated that I wasn't healing like those women. I found out later it's usually the second C-section that women bounce back from. No one told me that part. I felt weak. I was just mad at myself that I wasn't tougher. It just sucked. The distances east of Ramadi made the 300 Win Mag my rifle of choice, and I started taking it regularly on patrols. After the Army took the hospital, they continued taking fire and getting attacked. It didn't take too long before they started getting mortar fire as well. So we bumped out, fighting the insurgents who were shooting at them and looking for the mortar crews. One day we set up in a two-story building a short distance from the hospital. The Army tried using special gear to figure out where the mortars were being fired from, and we chose the house because it was near the area they identified. But for some reason, that day the insurgents decided to lie low. Maybe they were getting tired of dying. I decided to see if we could flush them out. I always carried an American flag inside my body armor. I took it out and strung some 550 cord, a general-purpose nylon rope sometimes called parachute cord, through the grommets. I tied the line to the lip of the roof, then threw it over the side so it draped down the side of the building. Within minutes, half a dozen insurgents stepped out with automatic machine guns and started shooting at my flag. We returned fire. Half of the enemy fell. The other half turned and ran. I still have the flag. They shot out 2 stars. Fair trade for their lives, by my accounting. As we bumped out, the insurgents would move farther away and try and put more cover between us and them. Occasionally, we'd have to call in air support to get them from behind walls or berms in the distance. Because of the fear of collateral damage, command and the pilots were reluctant to use bombs. Instead, they would just make strafing runs. We'd also get attack helicopters, Marine Cobras and Hueys, which would use machine guns and rockets. One day while we were on an overwatch, my chief and I spotted a man putting a mortar in the trunk of a car about 800 yards from us. I shot him. Another man came out of the building where he'd been, and my chief shot him. We called in an airstrike. An FA-18 put a missile on the car. There were massive secondaries. They'd loaded the car with explosives before we saw him. Among the sleepers. A night or two later, I found myself walking in the dark through a nearby village, stepping over bodies, not of dead people, but sleeping Iraqis. In the warm desert, Iraqi families would often sleep outside. I was on my way to take up a position so we could overwatch a raid on the marketplace where one of the insurgents had a shop. Our intelligence indicated this was where the weapons in the car we'd blown up had come from. 4 other guys and I had been dropped off about 6 kilometers away by the rest of the team, which was planning to mount a raid in the morning. Our assignment was to get into place ahead of them, scout and watch the area, then protect them as they arrived. It wasn't as dangerous as you might think to walk through insurgent-held areas at night. They were almost always asleep. The Iraqis would see our convoys arrive during the day and then leave before it got dark. So the bad guys would figure we were all back at the base. There'd be no guards posted, no lookouts, no pickets watching the area. Of course, you had to watch where you stepped. One of my platoon members nearly stepped on a sleeping Iraqi as we walked to our target area in the dark. Fortunately, he caught himself at the last second, and we were able to walk on without waking anyone. The Tooth Fairy had nothing on us. We found the marketplace and set up to watch it. It was a small row of tiny one-story shacks used as stores. There were no windows. You open a door and sell your wares right out of the hut. Not too long after we got to our hide, we received a radio call telling us that another unit was out somewhere in the area. A few minutes later, I spotted a suspicious group of people. "Hey," I said over the radio, "I see four guys carrying AKs and web gear, all mooged out. Are these our boys?" Web gear is webbing or vest and strap gears used to hold combat equipment. The men I saw looked like Mujahideen. By all mooged out, I meant they were dressed the way insurgents often did in the countryside, wearing the long man jammies and scarves. In the city, they often wore Western-style clothes. Tracksuits and warm-ups were big. The four men were coming from the river, which would be where I expected the guys to be coming from. "Hold on, we'll find out," said the comm guy on the other end of the radio. I watched him. I wasn't going to shoot him. No way was I going to take a chance and kill an American. The unit took its time responding to our talk, which, in turn, had to get a hold of my platoon guys. I watched as the men walked on. "Not ours," came the call back finally. "They canceled." "Great. Well, I just let four guys go in your direction." I'm sure if they had been out there, I never would have seen them. Ninjas. Everybody was pissed. My guys back at the Hummer sat ready, scanning the desert, waiting for the Mooj to appear. I went back to my own scan, watching the area they were supposed to hit. A few minutes later, what did I see but the four insurgents who passed me earlier? I got one. One of the other snipers got another before they could take cover. Then another six or seven insurgents appeared behind them. Now we were in the middle of a firefight. We started launching grenades. The rest of the platoon heard the gunfire and came hard. But fighters who'd stumbled past us melted away. The element of surprise lost, the platoon went ahead with the raid on the marketplace in the dark. They found some ammo and AKs, but nothing important in terms of a real weapons cache. We never found out what the insurgents who slipped past were up to. It was just another mystery of war.
Context of white supremacy. We will be picking back up. For me, it is on page 429. It's subtitled The Elite Elite. 429, when we get to the second audio segment, we are in chapter 9, when we get ready to rock and roll. For folks who would like to participate, the number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again is 760-569-7676. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone to dial in, you can use the free Flashbone. It works anywhere around the world, and it is free. Should be linked on the Black Talk Radio Network page. If you can't access that, you can just put in this address, which is tinytiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. That address again, tinytiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put in that address, click the link on the left side of the page for the Flash Player, Flash Phone. You'll see it. Once you do that, it will open a small window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 760-569-7676. On the next line, it will ask for the code. That code, again, is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can, whatever you're comfortable with, nickname, real name, random keys. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It should connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us, and it's the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *6. Once you do that, you will hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. We'll get you on the line, and you will be ready to go. With that, I will get the folks that are on the line. I will just say that this has been one of the easiest books ever for the book club. I feel like I don't have to do a whole lot, particularly with all of the attention that this book has garnered in the months since it's been out. But this has just been super, super easy. I feel like I don't have to do a whole lot of explaining or why did you pick this book? What are we supposed to learn? Just press play and put your feet up, and it should be self-explanatory. But the line should be open. If folks have things that they would like to share, feel free to chime in. Everybody who has a hand up, your line should be open.
Absolutely. One of the easiest. part I like to comment on is the comic book, the Punisher. And as a collector of that comic book, when I was younger, he was a military special forces who became a police officer and whose family was murdered by Kingpin or, drug cartels. His whole war was against drug cartels. The heads that he knew that was guilty of doing stuff. He also stole their money, too, and used it against them. Now, he wants to justify killing Arab people as he's the Punisher, because all of them, of course, are guilty of terrorizing white people who are in their country. taking their stuff. I don't find it strange because they need to fabricate any type of reason to kill and destroy. And we know that by now. But he also has one comment on the hippo person, who I suspect is probably a another black male or non-white male. It's just the way they talk. He talks about it. You don't really hear him describe anybody else in the group. Way to describe this person or persons that you just seem something's not right about this person. You know, there's just too much going on here about this particular person. And so you don't really hear too many other people that we would assume as being white. The hillbillies, there was not one person that stood out. He didn't describe different people that stood out compared to this guy here. So it's still suspect. I'm not sure if anybody else sees that as well, but I could have missed some information too because I was in and out. But those are the two I wanted to comment on for right now. And just leave it at that. I'll let somebody else get in right now.
Good night. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to comment on the chokeout thing. It sounded very homoerotic. He was saying something about the guy was a virgin and that everybody had, half the platoon had to go. And also, I was curious to why he named the place Gateway, G-A-Y-T-W-A-Y. And he made a comment also about savages, saying that they had taken so much from him. And I was I was confused because I didn't know what they took from him. And also, he made a comment about loving, I think, his wife or something like that. And I've come to the conclusion that white people don't know what love is and can't love. Whenever they say they love something, for example, they love dogs. They love dogs, and what they do is they will restrict the dog from being a dog. And things happen where now dogs have, like, cancer and diabetes and stuff like that. So white people, to me, can't love. And I think Michael Bradley talks about that, too, in his book, Ice Inheritance. Yes, and he said something also about getting creative to kill people. Like, that's just, like, he's just, like, the epitome of, like, the white psyche. I find that too, he uses motherfucker a lot. And I think it reminds me, it makes me think about Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing and what she talks about in regards to that. And that's all I have for now.
Greetings, everyone. This is Scotty from North Carolina. I kind of tuned in kind of late, but I did write some notes on what I heard. One of the things that really stood out to me that I have heard said on this program is that white people kill for fun. I recognize that sentiment often in the text. But anytime, I mean, I can't stress this enough. We have no way of knowing if these people are being truthful and his exploits, and he could be bragging. So I'll just take everything, you know, with a grain of salt that you hear from, you know, these people who we know are masters at deception and telling lies. Now, what I did hear and what I didn't hear, well, I heard him talking about this thermobaric rounds that they were using. I carried one of those rifles with a M203 grenade launcher attached to it. Thermobaric rounds, I had never heard of those before, but it reminds me of thermite. Now, he's trying to say that it produces, like, you know, a bigger bang and therefore more force. But if it has anything to do with thermite is a chemical that burns through metal. The first time I had really heard of thermite was 9/11 truthers talking about how thermite, they saw evidence that thermite was used on the 9/11 towers. So I don't know what he's talking about there, these thermobaric rounds. Never heard of those. But I do know that they use illegal weapons. Now, he talked about Fallujah and how Fallujah was totally destroyed. But what they did not talk about was that they use white phosphorus. White phosphorus is another chemical, and it is outlawed under international law, and its use is a war crime. And white phosphorus was used to destroy Fallujah. What it is a chemical. They shoot it up into the air, and if it touches you, it will burn all the way through to the bone. I have read accounts of the destruction in Fallujah that was due to this white phosphorus. They got another name for it. I forget what the name is called, but the technical term is white phosphorus. And so often what they would do is, I mean, these are cowards. Again, they will totally destroy an area, pound them from the air, pound them with these illegal weapons, and then it will go in and you know, just gun down anybody that survives. So these are not fair fights. White people do not fight fair. Again, And I have to keep reiterating, people need to stop bringing knives to gunfights. And these people will use anything illegal. They don't pay attention to any kind of rules of warfare, any kind of international law. They do not. You know, just destroying Fallujah itself is a civilian area. That is against, what is it, the Geneva Conventions. And we see that happening a lot with the destruction of Palestine and Gaza, just blowing up the infrastructure, blowing up hospitals, schools. To destroy a whole town like that, again, using white phosphorus, you know, that kind of stood out to me. Now, another thing that I took notes on that stood out to me was he said, I made sure when he was talking about the four guys who looked like Mujahideen. And I mean, that's typical dress in certain cultures and whatnot. And he tried to say, oh, if they was in the city, then they wore track suits and whatnot. But I had read an article today by another veteran. And he said that anybody who has claimed to kill that many people, that they were more than likely engaged in killing friendlies, meaning, you know, any kind of indigenous population that was helping, killing civilians. The guy mentioned in his article, I think it was in Slate, he mentioned in his article that in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, it's typical for everybody to be having guns. You know, talk about, you know, the United States open carry and how white people carry around guns. Same thing over there. You know, these people had guns. And so I note that he said that I want to make sure that I wasn't killing Americans. So that tells me right then and there, killing civilians, killing friendlies or whatnot, that was not even in his concern. If they weren't Americans, he was going to kill them. And so, wow, I mean, that's what I really got from that. And the thing about the wife and the so-called C-section and her saying, oh, I was mad because I wasn't healing up. You know, again, I find that kind of stuff to be braggadocious, you know, probably just bragging. Oh, I'm a tough old white woman. I was mad because I didn't heal up fast and whatnot. So those are the things that stood out to me that I took notes on the portion that I heard. I'm muting my mic.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How you doing, Gus? Thomas Smith from New York. How do you? How do all the callers? I had a few observations, but with the lady said earlier, with the homo eroticism, I picked that up too in that passage, and it was, you know, being choked out and chewed out and taking turns. I was like, man, this is sounding pretty gay. And with the gentleman who just spoke. When he was talking about the white phosphorus, I never heard of that. That was interesting. But the thermite, it might go off track. But when I used to work right across the street from 9/11 when it happened, and 2 days later, they made us, me and a few other black guys, you know, of course, the people who worked in the service department, they told us to go. They put us in a bus. They put cardboard on the windows, and we had to go to the office to get people's belongings that they left behind trying to get away from the buildings. And, you know, stuff like laptops and some people had specific requests like the Yankee tickets. I mean, it was crazy. And we had to go do this and get the FedExes and make sure the mail went out. It was so 2 days later when I got there and once you got off the bus and you could see the beams was cut. It was definitely like in a slanted line going up. It was cut. It wasn't like it something that broke. So I heard that thermite would be the only thing that could do that. From my observations from the book, while I was listening to it, I looked up the definition of insurgent because I was like, man, why do you keep calling these people insurgents? And I went to the, I always go to the beginning, so I went to the 1828 Noah Webster dictionary so I could see where it all started from because that's the first American dictionary, so they say. And it's a person who rises in opposition to civil or political authority. One who openly or actively resists execution of laws. Insurgent differs from a rebel. Thus, insurgent opposes the execution of particular laws, whereas the rebel attempts to overthrow or change the government. where he revolts and attempts to place his country under another jurisdiction. All rebels are insurgents, but all insurgents are not rebels. So I was like, man, why does he keep calling these people insurgents? I mean, here comes a few insurgents. I mean, it just makes it seem like someone that's so easy to kill. You know, it just sounds so horrible. Another observation I made, you know, with all the ball busting and having fun and hazing people in the midst of, you know, all the homoerotic talk and, you know, just going out between in and just killing people and using different weapons. Let's try this. Let's try that. Giving people crazy nicknames. I mean, they're just having a lot of fun with this. Going to get a Crusader tattoo. You know, that's like someone putting a Nazi tattoo, especially if you're going to the Middle East. I mean, why would you put a Crusader tattoo? So that kind of lets me know what they want. I mean, this was like a religious war to some of these guys. He's having seizures. Another kid, one born with complication, but he wants to get back to his boys in Afghanistan. Wanting to fight so bad, he robbed a med rack to med rack him in. I mean, if this stuff is true, I mean, this guy's, he had a death wish. Feigning to kill someone, I mean, just got there, begged someone to get up on the tower. As soon as he got there, there's two insurgents. You know, a few minutes later, they had open season on Iraqis. I got him up to about 500 murders so far. He's way past what they gave him. The savages, the insurgent, but for the first time this passage, he used the word terrorist. That was the first time he called, that I remember, an Iraqi or Afghanistan terrorist, but he used that right before he said they went and shot up a mosque, which was kind of interesting. Spray painting walls after they defeated people and on buildings around the city. Sound like gang wars in the 80s. Like, you know, you just took out cool guys here, so you're going to spray paint, you know, whatever your gang is on the wall, marking their territory. And that was about all I had.
Anybody else with us who hasn't shared yet, have something they want to get in? We get everybody. I thought there were saw some other numbers or other hands from folks who I didn't think had shared yet. Did we get everybody?
Yes, can I be heard?
Oh, yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers, listeners. I just enjoyed listening to the commentary from the other callers. I said, you know, that listening to this book and thinking about the fact that there was at least two other sniper books out that had twists in them, like one killing his brother and another one shooting his wife's lover or something. You know, not just totally into the killing, but this book in particular is allowing us to see the mind of a pathological white killer. And this is the mindset of not only the SEALs, his comrades, and this and that, but it's permeated throughout this society. There's a lot of police officers, other white people that are in positions of some type of authority that has this mindset. And it would behoove us to investigate this and understand what's going on inside the mind of these pathological killers.
Q&A queue is cleared.
Can I still be heard?
Oh, yes, sir. We can hear you.
Okay, one other thing, there was another book called Operation Dark Heart. It was Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer that had wrote about some classified missions, and that the Department of Defense had sanitized his book. But I'm listening to this, and this guy is revealing types of weaponry, missions that he went on, how many people he killed, this and that. It would seem that either this is a propaganda ploy that the Department of Defense is allowing, or he's fabricating quite a bit of his exploits, and they are not really that concerned. But I'll just continue to listen to those. I'm enjoying the commentary. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. To your last one, I think it could be both a combination of propaganda and lies all mixed in together. The caller at 1249, did you have anything you wanted to add as well? 1249?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Oh, before you, I hope I didn't disconnect anybody. My finger slipped. That was why you heard me say, oops, my finger slipped when I was trying to make sure I got everybody who had a hand up because some other folks had called in. So, but my finger did slip. I hope I did not bump anybody off the line. If you dialed in the comments, I think folks are still here, but it was not done purposely. My finger just had a mistake. Sorry about that. But go ahead, 1249.
Yeah. Well, good evening, guys. Good evening, everybody. And I called in late. I didn't even hear the first section of the book, so I'm looking forward to hearing the second part. But I called in a week before last, I believe it was, and I work in Naval Special Warfare. I work with SEALs deployed to Iraq with these guys on two occasions and some other training missions. But it's interesting to hear the comments, man. It's just, for me, I'm living it. I'm still living it. And I don't want to say too much because I may give myself away, and I'm trying not to do that because you never know who's listening. But and as Gus has alluded to before, I am afraid of white people, and I think we all should be afraid. But I'm behind enemy lines, literally. And you work with these guys every day. And Chris Kyle, like I said before, he's not singular. It's a bunch of these guys getting trained every day just like him. And a lot of these guys have the same mindset, right wing, high school educated, not very intelligent guys, just basically clones being produced to go out and do what he's done. So everybody's right on the right track with what they're getting from this book, especially Mr. Reed, what he was talking about the rounds that are being used, those thermite rounds. They were initially used for anti-tank and anything with metal, to melt metal, but now there's different applications on smaller levels being used with these type of rounds. So you can imagine what a thermite would do to a human body if it can melt metal. So just paints a picture of what kind of destruction is being doled out to non-white people around the globe with these individuals. But I will be listening in on the second segment. I appreciate, you know, being allowed to talk, and I may have more to add later on. So I'll just stand by listening. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Get a few comments in, and then if other folks who are with us, or if anybody that's already shared, if you have other things that you want to make sure you get in, we'll have time for that as well. One of the things that, in addition, before I even get to my comments, the amount of material, just the fact that we're doing this book right now, I had to give myself a pat on the back, number one, for picking this book and for waiting to pick this book, because I was going to do this book in 2012. I got this book. I've been sitting on this book since he was still alive when I think I got it the year it came out. And I was like, yeah, we should do this. This is everything that you all have said. That's what I thought. When I first saw this, it was a bestseller and everything else. And I'm glad that I waited because there's so much more attention on the book and the film now, since it's, you know, in theaters and Academy Awards and all that. So I'm super glad that I waited, and I'm super glad that I picked this book back in December. Just because it's been incredible, the amount of commentary that has been generated. Even some of the articles and reports that people wrote 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, have resurfaced. Like, people wrote these articles and stuff, you know, years ago, and nobody had a whole lot to say about it. And now, with all the extra attention, it's been renewed and rejuvenated. At any rate, and I will get to some of that, because some of the stuff that I saw even over the past 7 days since we did the last book report has been revealing as well, and it touched on some of the things you all have said. To the book, though, I thought it was fascinating because I brought up last week, why do you all think Taya was included in the book, these passages where she talks about recuperating from childbirth and her frustrations with him being enlisted and all of that. I particularly thought it was interesting just from a literary standpoint. Kyle is allegedly giving this report about going to give this talk as a quote unquote expert about, you know, tactical decisions and type of ammo, rounds you should have, gear, all that stuff. He's doing all this, and they switch from that to Taya, and she's talking about confrontations that they had while he was at home and her being upset about him re-enlisting. And I'm just like, wow, just from a transition point of view, like, there was no chapter break, no nothing. Like, it just goes from him talking to these people and saying, you all are kind of stupid, you should already know this, I can't believe you haven't learned this before, to, man, I'm so upset that he's re-enlisting. It just seemed strange to me, almost some discontinuity there, unless I'm missing it, unless it's just about general confrontations with other people, which still seems like a bit of a stretch. The next thing, he says, that for me, this is on 381. He says, more importantly, anything we told him to do, he's talking about this guy, Ryan. Anything we told him to do, he would do. He was such a hard worker, so sincere, and so damn funny that at some point we just went, I love you. You are the man. Because no matter how he looked, he truly was a SEAL and a damn good one. Now, this is directly the page after Taya gives her comments about her being upset because, you know, she's saying, why are you re-enlisting? This is ridiculous. You could go out there and die and that would totally ruin our family and all this. And, you know, whatever. I'm going back to kill some more non-white people, insurgents, savages. And I'm just like, wow. Like, again, the homoeroticism. You have that as a transition. Wife, I'm furious. I have a newborn. You've done, you know, multiple tours already. We need you to be here. I'm not going to tell you not to go, but I mean, really, that's going to let me know that you really do not value us as much as you value being able to go out and kill non-white people. And that's the transition. Not only does he go back and deploy again, he's talking about, I loved this tubby white man, which, I mean, wow, that's just telling me a lot, everything that you all already touched on about the homoeroticism and gayness of all this. Moving forward, this is in the subsection, it's chapter 8, subsection Mark Lee, where he says, to all this, the choking out, everything that you all said, again, the super gayness, the next portion where he's talking about Primo, I guess is his name. This good old boy, and again, even going from the audio clip that I began the program with, the interview that was on Tell Me More with Michelle Martin, where they gave the statistics, where they said out of about 2,000 Navy SEALs, there are about 50 of them are black, which is not even 3%, where this is the environment where it's full of good old boys. I just take that to mean racist white people who enjoy that. White people kill for fun. We get an opportunity to go out here and practice the religion of white supremacy and get all kinds of new gadgets. I think one of our investors, she has said, Dr. Kanban, where she said, or excuse me, it was actually Dr. Welsing. She has said, you know, we black people, we're at our best when we're fighting against racism. She said, conversely, I think that's also true for whites. They are at their best when they are practicing racism. That's when all of their creativity and imagination and skill and innovation, that's when it comes out. And I mean, white people even brag about this because they'll say that war, that's when you get all kinds of inventions. That's when you get all kinds of new technology and what have you, is when, hey, we are devoting all of our efforts to killing. That's when you get a lot of inventions. And that same sort of mentality to me is present in this book, as Mr. Reed and some of y'all were already talking about. I can't hear you, but I'm not done yet. Okay. He had a portion. He did an interview with – he did a bunch of interviews. Chris Kyle, he did an interview with Conan O'Brien, 2012. I think I put it – somebody put it on the Facebook page. You can check it out. But where he says that he – bragging about violence, being in these bar fights and what have you – he says that the guy told him to hit hard and run fast. And that's in the book here. Reminded me of him saying that in the interview. And that same sort of mentality, the violence, the aggression, and this is about having fun and then not being held accountable for it. And of course, the police are not going to pursue some white, maybe SEAL, white people in general, but certainly not a white person who's in a part of the U.S. military. The tattoos, you already touched on that. That would be a Dr. Welsing moment as well. The religion of white supremacy. Let's see. Also, the portion where while I was at home, Taya became pregnant with our second child. Again, that was a lot of strain for my wife. My father told Taya that he was sure once I saw my son and spent time with him, I wouldn't want to re-enlist to go back to the war. Wrong. But while we talked about it, in the end, I didn't feel there was much of a question about what to do. I was a SEAL. I was a killer, not a father. And that was in the Time interview. I did put that on the Facebook page. He did an interview with Time magazine with a white woman, and she asked him at the end, she said, because he was no longer a Navy SEAL at this point. She says, well, what if that was the thing that you were best at doing? And he said, well, that wasn't the thing I was best at doing. I'm a great husband, and I'm a great father, and I'm a great businessman, and all this other stuff. Like, you know, and he said, even in that, he says, don't take killing deer away from me, with a laugh. But I thought that was a great question, and I didn't even believe him, because I'm going from the book that I read, your wife gets pregnant, and you are, peace out, I'm going back to go kill more non-white people. That does not sound like an A-plus husband to me. That does not sound like an A-plus father to me. He goes on in this, he says, I was a SEAL. I was trained for war. I was made for it. My country was at war and it needed me, and I missed it. I missed the excitement and the thrill. I loved killing bad guys. I mean, that is, you could take the words right from Mr. Nero's mouth. White people kill for fun. And the movie, I think I have like 20 minutes left. I've been really slacking about watching it because I know we still have, I think, two or three more sessions of this to go. But this does not come through in the movie. And a lot of people that have read the book and seen the film have made that critique and saying that that just doesn't come through, that they did. I mean, the book, in my opinion, I think is propaganda as well. But the film is even worse because they cut out a lot of these elements from the film. Same thing with the transition where they bring when they're at the hospital and the birth happens, and Taya's like, I don't want to hold the child. And he's like, oh man, I'm going back to war. And she doesn't even want to hold the child. And, you know, what is all this? They don't stay on that for a hot minute. That is the end of chapter 8. And they move from that, her at the hospital, what's going to happen? Could there be complications with the child, or could there be complications with the wife and the C-section and all? Punishers, us getting these tattoos and going out and killing non-white people. I mean, it's just like, wow. Like, it, to me, that makes it even worse to include this, because it just shows repeatedly having a child, a newborn, your child giving birth for the first time, you getting married. All of that is a distant, I can't even say second, that's like a distant fifth, that's not even on the same page as being able to go out and kill in terms of white values under the system of white supremacy. The punishers, you already talked about that. I thought that was great. The commentary you all shared. The pornographic and homoeroticism in the book, I think it is a consistent element in some of the reviews and people that have talked about that. Not many, but some have pointed that out as well. On 400, page 400, this is in chapter 9, where he's talking about shooting people, and he says, I went out, took my sniper rifle. Almost as soon as I got in position, I saw two guys skirting around the distance looking for a spot to shoot from. I waited until they popped up behind cover. Bang, I got the first one. His friend turned around and started to run. Bang, got him too. This is like being at the carnival and target practice. This is not at all. And he says that. He says that repeatedly, not just in the text, but in some of the different interviews that I watched today when he was on Conan. He did an interview with Bill O'Reilly where he just says this over and over again, that, hey, you can't look at it as people. You know, these are not human beings that you're killing. You know, I wish I could have killed more of them to save my guys. It's like I'm, as I said, at the carnival shooting a little target or something, or a little paper or what have you. This is great. Like, you know, I might get a prize when all this is over. Let's see. I had a few other comments. Yeah, we heard this when the book skipped forward. We heard some of this before. I remember that where he says it was like a psyops campaign for them to put the Punisher and all of this to spread fear and intimidation, almost sounding like terrorism, what they're doing, their presence amongst these non-white people. I thought that was significant as well. Oh, the homoeroticism. I will leave this for Dr. Wells in a moment. He says, don't get me wrong. When they were at the bridge and they were trying to find the explosive device, he says, don't get me wrong. I wasn't charging across the bridge. I had my rifle in one hand and the other parked protectively on my family jewels, consistently going back and making all these references to penises and urine and testicles and anuses. It's just very, very homoerotic. The homosexual nature of this text is consistent throughout the book from beginning to end. I think we said that, and I've seen a few, but not many people who've touched on that element of the text. I haven't seen where that is as prevalent in the film. I'll stop there. Anybody else have other comments they wanted to make sure they got in?
I just wanted to say also about the Punisher, he had a sidekick who was also fat or overweight. And I just want to put that in context to this hippo person. So, you know, don't seem like the story is original.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you kind of touched on just thing I wanted to add and answer the question of a caller who said, why does he keep calling them insurgents and things of that nature? I will point to another book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. I interviewed the author, Nick Terse, and he said that, like, for example, medics, and that they are prevented from referring to the enemy in any kind of term or any kind of way that projects you a human being, you know, that you're killing a human being. In Vietnam, they were always, soldiers were made to refer to these people as gooks, chinks, any kind of derogatory name, no name, you couldn't call them Vietnamese or anything that might, you know, hint to that these are human beings. And that's to desensitize you. And I kind of see the same thing playing out here in the United States with the police force, and, well, not just the police force, but with American society and how black people are demonized. You know, Darren Wilson talking about Michael Brown, a demon. You know, he was grunting like a demon, and just a constant demonization of black people. And that's, again, to desensitize, you know, individuals so that they don't have any kind of sympathy, you know, for the killing. Now, I was not around combat soldiers that much. I was in a communications unit, which was predominantly black, and none of us used that sort of language. I never heard any of the non-black people in our unit use that kind of language. But I'm sure that kind of language is probably prevalent among, you know, combat troops. And that's to desensitize them, to keep them from viewing these people as human beings, because then they may hesitate, you know, and not kill them. And that's what I got from that. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Before there's other folks that have anything, you can hop in as well. We should have at least actually more than 10 minutes if you have things you want to get in, or people if you are listening and would like to participate. It's a piece I would recommend. It is actually a piece that is supposed to be in defense of this, of the film slash book, Chris Kyle. It's titled The Demonization of Chris Kyle. This is at the National Review. It's by Ian Tuttle. I think this is a white person looking at his picture. I might be wrong. But he talks about a lot of the people that have critiqued the movie, the book, over the years, especially the last couple months or months since the film came out. He references Rania Kalik, who is a non-white female. She was on Uprising Radio, KPFK. She was actually on with Scott McEwen, the co-author of this book. On Chris Kyle, she was on with him and the other co-author, and she was giving her view about this guy is a racist who's just enjoying killing non-white people, and that is not portrayed in the book. And it reveals a lot about the people that are going to see this film, white people, the fact that they would rejoice and celebrate this, because this is nothing to celebrate. And so he's picking out all these folks and saying, oh, they're just trashing and demonizing, you know, an American hero. But actually, the way it reads, it's almost like, yeah, this is accurate, what everybody is saying. One of the lines where he says, the answer is simple, because the right is just like Chris Kyle. West thinks the similarity is racism. The right has latched on to Kyle because Chris Kyle is good and brown people are bad and America is in danger and Chris Kyle saved us. For Laura Miller, senior writer at Salon, the similarity is stupidity. Kyle was, she writes, afflicted by his steadfast imperviousness to any nuance, subtlety, or ambiguity, and his lack of imagination and curiosity, and in that he was all too emblematic of the blustering, tragically misguided self-confidence of the George W. Bush years. From the Daily KOS, writing back in 2012, admiration of Kyle is Freudian projection. Chris Kyle was feted by Bill O'Reilly last week. His deeds were recounted and killing admired by the Fox News faithful. There is an odd homoeroticism, or is it homosocial worship, in this interview where O'Reilly, as an arch-conservative, is channeling a deep fascination with the how of death and a type of hyper-masculinity that is the bleeding heart of right-wing authoritarianism. Here, O'Reilly reminds the viewer of why straight men enjoy watching the freakishly large penises that dominate much of American pornography. Hero worship, with no small amount of projection, is and remains the thing. It is the means for a visceral thrill. He goes on to just continuing with a lot of the other critiques. Rania Kolick specifically, she retweeted a lot of what people were saying, white people were saying when they went to see the film, where they this person says, Reagan Brock says, teared up at the end of American Sniper, great fucking movie, and now I really want to kill some fucking ragheads. And it's just tons of this sort of commentary from whites. And also, she has been terrorized, where people are saying she should be raped and killed for having the audacity to comment and have something negative or a critique of American Sniper, the book, or the film. I'll stop there, but there are tons. There was a great piece in NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. There was a great piece there as well where they were talking about, it just came out today, they were talking about his claims, Chris Kyle's claims, that he had been at the Superdome and shot black looters during Hurricane Katrina, and he was just talking about this guy is a liar, notorious liar, same thing you all have been talking about in the book. I'll hush if other folks have things they want to make sure they get in.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I want to throw something in. I don't know, Gus, if down the road, this is 757, by the way. I don't know if you want to continue down this Navy SEAL path with the next book, but there's a book written by a Navy SEAL titled Warrior Princess, a U.S. Navy SEAL's journey to coming out transgender. And the guy's name is Chris Beck. He goes, or she, I don't know, he, she, goes by Kristen Beck now. And he's living, she's living as a female now. You can find this information on the internet. I believe it came out 2013. What's interesting is when this story broke, it was a lot of buzz at the command about this Navy SEAL, who, by the way, is one of the elite of the elite. You have levels of SEALs. You know, you got your basic, what they call knuckle dragger, who's just a guy who's just a big brute who is basically used as muscle. He's a breacher. He might kick down doors and stuff like that. You got the full spectrum from the knuckle dragger to the real smart and intellectual guy. But then you have the DevCrew SEAL, and these are the guys that get the missions, like the guys who went out and killed Osama bin Laden, for instance. These are the DevCrew guys, the elite of the elite, and they're very strict about who gets into what's called DevCrew or the development group. And Kristen Beck, or Chris Beck, was one of those elite SEALs with tons of deployments and having done who knows what in what parts of the world. What's interesting is at the command there was conversation when this guy came out as transgender, and a lot of non-SEALs, you know, were laughing and joking about it. And one of the SEALs who knew the guy personally was very defensive of this individual, talking about how great of a SEAL he was and great of an operator. But on the flip side of that, when there was talk about gays in the military, there was a lot of ridicule. So defending this transgender SEAL, you know, who's supposed to be alpha male, but ridiculing, you know, sailors who came out of the closet, who were allowed to come out by the president, you know, was kind of funny. But it just, you know, they run the gamut, and I think it'd be interesting. I don't know if you want to follow this book, read this book in the next book club reading, but it would be interesting to compare and contrast this Steele's experiences, you know, in deployment and being gay and having to stay in the closet, or maybe he wasn't in the closet, maybe he was the bunt boy out there on deployment for the rest of these SEALs. But it would be interesting read, even if it wasn't read on the cow. So just wanted to throw that in. That's all I got.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, Thomas Smith again. I just spoke to you know, I'm using my daughter's phone because my wife's on the house phone. And she's, you know, who are you talking to on my phone? And I said, oh, I'm talking on the radio show. And what are you talking about? So I told her about American Sniper. She says, oh, my teacher told me I should read that book. And I'm like, your teacher told you she should read this book? And she's like, yeah. And I just thought that's strange. She's 13. And in her nonfiction class, they have to do a report on a book that is also a movie about. And I just thought it was real strange that that was on her list of things that the teacher would tell her to read.
Wow, that is fascinating. I mean, on the one hand, I was like, yeah, you should read it. That'll give you a great understanding of who white folks are and, you know, what we're dealing with. And then on the other hand, it's like, wow, like this book where he's saying, killing these motherfuckers and what are you doing and pissing, I mean,
yeah, really? Exactly.
A 13-year-old?
Unbelievable, man. Of course, the teacher's white. So, you know. But, you know, I just was like, this book here? I'm like, I don't think this is appropriate for your age, but, you know, I said it's a good book, you know. But I just can't believe that was on her list of all books.
I wouldn't be surprised if they have them. Film trips to go see something like that. I know they have done school field trips to go see Schindler's List and all kinds of other things that I don't think are particularly appropriate for young children to go see, but it would not surprise me at all if that is being done.
I wouldn't be surprised either.
Other folks that chimed in have comments they wanted to make sure they got in as well.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Jamie from D.C. I just wanted to comment. I don't know if anybody caught in the text this evening about Chris Kyle discussing one of one of the other gentlemen that he was in Iraq with, Marcus Luttrell, and had commented about his book, Lone Survivor, I guess, and how that was actually, I think, a movie that came out maybe last year or 2 years ago. If anybody, any of the callers, had maybe seen that and had had any sort of insight as to why maybe this was such a much more popular movie and book than maybe that one was, because I just found it kind of interesting that two texts, you know, had kind of come out not too long after one another, and how one gained so much more popularity than the other. I know we've often alluded to the fact of this being far more, propaganda type. So I was just wondering if anyone had seen the movie or read the book and had any information on that, because I just thought that was kind of interesting that another individual that he had been in Iraq with or in Afghanistan with had also had a book that came out, and I was just curious to find out if anyone had any more information on that.
The infamous Mark Wahlberg was in Lone Survivor.
Yes, exactly. That's what I saw.
I haven't seen it, and I haven't read the book. I believe Mr. Luttrell did the foreword for this book, but that notwithstanding, at least one thought might be, it's been my experience that if this is what they're reporting in terms of these two of these troops were, they were in a tough spot or what have you, and it was only one person survived, it's been my experience that if any sort of situation where white people are having a difficult time is not going to be quite as popular as where white people just get to go in and kill all the non-white people and rah, 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 and cheer, and it's great, all that sort of thing. Same way I would think a film like Black Hawk Down, even though I think that is well known, I don't think that is going to be as popular as this film, where white people are struggling and having a tough time, if that makes sense. But I haven't seen the film, so I could be totally wrong.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I thought it was interesting the last caller caught that part that Chris Kyle was giving a plug for this other book, Lone Survivor. I saw the movie and some of the comments about that, because the whole thing started when the one guy didn't want to kill some civilians that had spotted their position. So then, see, it's this propaganda spin that they do in literature and these movies, the media, is to deceive you that they're really humane and that they don't really want to harm innocent civilians. But it's those objectified savages that we have to rid the world of. You know, I thought that it's strange that any time a veteran or some guy that's been in combat comes back and he's seen some horrible things, had to kill some people or whatever, he really doesn't want to talk about that. You know, that's kind of been archived in his mind, and he has to live with it, but he don't go around talking about it. It just seems so out of character for someone to not only bring that out into the forefront, but put it in a book and then advertise, you know, in this manner. So it just goes to show the depth of the viciousness and evil that goes on in the mind of some of these white individuals. I'll mute my line and give someone else a chance.
Yeah, this film grossed $125 million, which is not bad, right? I mean, that's, it did pretty well for a film, I suspect. The budget was $40 million, so, hey, they did well. American Sniper did that in 1 week. So, huge difference in this film's popularity and Lone Survivor. But I will make an effort to check that out before the program wraps up, before we finish the book, I mean, so that we can, or if other folks, if you all check it out, the book, the film, whichever, and you want to compare and contrast, we can do that as well. I thought there was another person that dialed in who hadn't got a chance to share yet, but then I don't know if they'd got disconnected or what have you, but we will go ahead and get to the second audio clip. If you did not get to share or you had something else, just jot it down, make a note of what have you, and then we'll get your hand once the second audio clip finishes up. We are in Chapter 9, the Elite Elite. That's where we are, Chapter 9. For me, it's 429. We'll do the second audio, wrap up, and then folks should have ample time to share additional thoughts that they have. Context of White Supremacy, American Sniper, Chris Kyle.
The Elite Elite. I think all SEALs highly respect our brothers in the Elite Anti-Terror Unit you've heard so much about at home. They are an elite group within an elite group. We didn't interact with them in Iraq much. The only other time I had much to do with them came a few weeks later after we got into Ramadi proper. They had heard we were out there slaying a huge number of savages, and so they sent one of their snipers over to see what we were doing. I guess they wanted to find out what we were doing that worked. Looking back, I regret not having tried to join. At the time, they weren't using snipers as heavily as the other teams were. The assaulters were doing the majority of the work, and I didn't want to be an assaulter. I was loving what I was doing. I wanted to be a sniper. I was getting used to my rifle and killing enemies. Why give it up? move to the East Coast and become a new guy all over again. And that's not even considering the buds-like school you have to get through to prove you belong. I would have had to spend a number of years as an assaulter before working my way up to be a sniper again. Why do that when I was already sniping and loving it? But now that I've heard about their ops and what they accomplished, I think I should have gone for it. The guys have a reputation for being arrogant and more than a little full of themselves. That's plain wrong. I had the opportunity to meet a few after the war when they came out to a training facility I run. They were extremely down to earth, very humble about their achievements. I absolutely wished I was going back out with them. Civilians and savages. The offensive in Ramadi had yet to start, officially, but we were getting plenty of action. One day intel came in concerning insurgents planting IEDs along a certain highway. We went out there and put it under surveillance. We'd also hit the houses and watch for ambushes on convoys and American bases. It's true that it can be difficult to sort out civilians from insurgents in certain situations, but here the bad guys made it easy for us. UAVs would watch a road, for example, and when they saw someone planting a bomb, they could not only pinpoint the booby trap, but follow the insurgent back to his house. That gave us excellent intel on where the bad guys were. Terrorists going to attack Americans would give themselves away by moving tactically against approaching convoys or when coming close to a base. They'd sneak around with their AKs ready. It was very easy to spot them. They also learned to spot us. If we took over a house in a small hamlet, we would keep the family inside for safety. The people who lived nearby would know that if the family wasn't outside by 9 o'clock in the morning, there were Americans inside. That was an open invitation for any insurgent in the area to come and try and kill us. It became so predictable, it seemed to happen according to a time schedule. Around about 9 in the morning, you'd have a firefight. Things would slack off around midday. Then around 3 or 4 in the afternoon, you'd have another. If the stakes weren't life and death, it would have been funny. And at the time, it was funny, in a perverse kind of way. You didn't know which direction they'd attack from, but the tactics were almost always the same. The insurgents would start out with automatic fire, pop off a bit here, pop off there. Then you'd get the RPGs, a flurry of fire. Finally, they'd scatter and try to get away. One day, we took out a group of insurgents a short distance from the hospital. We didn't realize it at the time, but Army intel passed the word later on that the insurgent command had made a cell phone call to someone asking for more mortarmen, because the team that had been hit in the hospital had just been killed. Their replacements never showed up. Shame. We would have killed them, too. Everyone knows by now about Predators, the UAVs that supplied a lot of intelligence to American forces during the war. But what many don't know is that we had our own backpack UAVs, small man-launched aircraft about the size of an RC aircraft kids of all ages play with in the States. They fit in a backpack. I never got to operate one, but they did seem kind of cool. The trickiest part, at least from what I could see, was the launch. You had to throw it pretty hard to get it airborne. The operator would rev the engine, then fling it into the air. It took a certain amount of skill. Because they flew low and had relatively loud little engines, the backpack UAVs could be heard on the ground. They had a distinctive whine, and the Iraqis soon learned that the noise meant we were watching. They became cautious as soon as they heard it, which defeated the purpose. Things got so heavy at some points that we had to take up 2 different radio bands, one to communicate with our talk and one to use among the platoon. There was so much radio traffic back and forth that comms from the talk would overrun us during contact. When we first started going out, our CO told our top watch to wake him every time we got into a tick, a military acronym that stands for Troops in Contact or Combat. Then we were getting in so much combat that he revised the order. We were only to notify him if we'd been in a tick for an hour. Then it was, only notify me if someone gets injured. Shark Base was a haven during this time, a little oasis of rest and recreation. Not that it was very fancy. It had a stone floor, and the windows were blocked by sandbags. At first, our cots were practically touching. and the only home he touched was the banged-up footlockers. But we didn't need much. We'd go out for 3 days, come back for a day. I'd sleep, then maybe play video games for the rest of the day, talk on the phone to back home, use the computer. Then it was time to gear up and go back out. You had to be careful when you were talking on the phone. Operational security, OPSEC, to use yet another military term, was critical. You couldn't say anything to anyone that might give away what we were doing or what we planned to do, or even specifically what we had done. All of our conversations from the base were recorded. There was software that listened for key words. If enough came up, they'd pull the conversation, and you could very well get in trouble. At one point, somebody ran their mouth about an operation, and we all got cut off for a week. He was pretty humiliated, and of course, we reamed him out. He felt appropriately remorseful. Sometimes the bad guys made it easy for us. One day we went out and set up in a village near the main road. It was a good spot. We were able to get a few insurgents as they tried passing through the area on their way to attack the hospital. All of a sudden, a bongo truck, a small work vehicle with a cab and a bed in the back where a business might carry equipment, careened from the road toward our house. Rather than equipment, the truck was carrying 4 gunmen in the back who started shooting at us as the truck drove across the fortunately wide yard. I shot the driver. The vehicle drifted to a halt. The passenger in the front hopped out and ran to the driver's side. One of my buddies shot him before they could get going. We lit up the rest of the insurgents, killing them all. A short while later, I spotted a dump truck heading down the main road. I didn't think all that much about it until it turned into the driveway of the house and started coming straight at us. We'd already interviewed the owners of the house and knew no one there drove a dump truck, and it was pretty obvious from his speed that he wasn't there to pick up some dirt. Tony shot the driver in the head. The vehicle veered off and crashed into another building nearby. A helo came in a short while later and blew up the truck. A Hellfire missile whooshed in and the dump truck erupted. It had been filled with explosives. Finally, a plan. By early June, the Army had come up with a plan to take Ramadi back from the insurgents. In Fallujah, the Marines had worked systematically through the city chasing and then pushing the insurgents out. Here, the insurgents were going to come to us. The city itself was wedged between waterways and swampland. There was limited access by road. The Euphrates and the Habaniya Canal bounded the city on the north and west. There was one bridge on either side near the northwestern tip. To the south and east, a lake, swamps, and a seasonal drainage canal helped form a natural barrier to the countryside. The U.S. forces would come in from the perimeters of the city, the Marines from up north, and the Army on the other three sides. We would establish strongholds in various parts of the city, demonstrating that we were in control and essentially daring the enemy to attack. When they did attack, we would fight back with everything we had. We'd set up more and more footholds, gradually extending control over the entire city. The place was a mess. There was no functioning government, and it was beyond lawless. Foreigners entering the city were instant targets for killing or kidnapping, even if they were in armored convoys. But the place was a worse hell for ordinary Iraqis. Reports have estimated that there were more than 20 insurgent attacks against Iraqis every day. The easiest way to be killed in the city was join the police force. Meanwhile, corruption was rife. The Army analyzed the terrorist groups in the city and decided there were 3 different categories. Hardcore Islamist fanatics, associated with Al-Qaeda and similar groups, locals who were a little less fanatic, though they still wanted to kill Americans, and opportunistic criminal gangs who were basically trying to make a living off the chaos. The first group had to be eliminated because they would never give up. They would be our main focus in the coming campaign. The other 2 groups, though, might be persuaded to either leave, quit killing people, or work with the local tribal leadership. So part of the Army plan would be to work with the tribal leadership to bring peace to the area. By all accounts, they had grown tired of the insurgents and the chaos they had brought and wanted them gone. The situation and plan were a lot more complicated than I can sum up, but to us, on the ground, all of this was irrelevant. We didn't give a damn about the nuances. What we saw, what we knew, was that many people wanted to kill us, and we fought back. The Jundis. There was one way the overall plan did affect us, and not for the better. The Ramadi offensive wasn't supposed to be just about American troops. On the contrary, the new Iraqi army was supposed to be the front and center in the effort to retake the city and make it safe. The Iraqis were there. Front? No. Center? As a matter of fact, yes, but not quite in the way you're thinking. Before the assault began, we were ordered to help put an Iraqi face on the war, the term command and the media used for pretending that the Iraqis were actually taking the lead in making their country safe. We trained Iraqi units, and when feasible, though not necessarily desirable, took them with us on operations. We worked with three different groups. We called them all Jundis, Arabic for soldiers, although technically some were police. No matter which force they were with, they were pathetic. We had used a small group of scouts during our operations east of the city. When we went into Ramadi, we used SMPs. They were a type of special police. And then we had a third group of Iraqi soldiers that we used in villages outside of the city. During most operations, we would put them in the middle of our columns, Americans at the front, the Iraqis in the center, Americans at the rear. If we were inside a house, they would sit on the first floor doing security and talking with the family, if there was one there. As fighters went, they sucked. The brightest Iraqis, it seemed, were usually insurgents, fighting against us. I guess most of our Jundis had their hearts in the right place, but as far as proficient military fighting went, let's just say they were incompetent, if not outright dangerous. One time a fellow SEAL named Brad and I were fixing to go into a house. We were standing outside the front door, with one of our Jundis directly behind us. Somehow the Jundi's gun got jammed. Idiotically, he flicked off the safety and hit the trigger, causing a burst of rounds to blow right next to me. I thought they'd come from the house. So did Brad. We started returning fire, dumping bullets through the door. Then I heard all this shouting behind me. Someone was dragging an Iraqi whose gun had gone off. Yes, the gunfire had come from us, not anyone inside the house. I'm sure the Jundi was apologizing, but I wasn't in the mood to listen, then or later. Brad stopped firing, and the SEAL who'd come up to get the door leaned back. I was still sorting out what the hell had happened when the door to the house popped open. An elderly man appeared, hands trembling. "Come in, come in," he said. "There's nothing here, nothing here." I doubt he realized how close it came to that being true. Besides being particularly inept, a lot of Jundis were just lazy. You'd tell them to do something and they'd reply, "Inshallah." Some people translate that as "God willing." What it really means is, "Ain't gonna happen." Most of the Jundis wanted to be in the army to get a steady paycheck, but they didn't want to fight, let alone die for their country. For their tribe, maybe. The tribe, their extended family, that was where their true loyalty lay. And for most of them, what was going on in Ramadi had nothing to do with that. I realize that a lot of the problem has to do with the screwed-up culture in Iraq. These people have been under a dictatorship for all their lives. Iraq as a country meant nothing to them, or at least nothing good. Most were happy to be rid of Saddam Hussein, very happy to be free people, but they didn't understand what that really meant, the other things that come with being free. The government wasn't going to be running their lives anymore, but it also wasn't going to be giving them food or anything else. It was a shock, and they were so backward in terms of education and technology that for Americans, it often felt like being in the Stone Age. You can feel sorry for them, but at the same time, you don't want these guys trying to run your war for you. And giving them the tools they needed to progress is not what my job was all about. My job was killing, not teaching. We went to great lengths to make them look good. At one point during the campaign, a local official's son was kidnapped. We got intel that he was being held at a house next to a local college. We went in at night, crashing through the gates and taking down a large building to use for the overwatch. While I watched from the roof of the building, Some of my boys took down the house, freeing the hostage without any resistance. Well, this was a big deal locally, so when it was photo op time, we called in our Jundies. They got credit for the rescue, and we drifted into the background. Silent professionals. That sort of thing happened all across the theater. I'm sure there were plenty of stories back in the States about how much good the Iraqis were doing and how we were training them. Those stories will probably fill the history books. They're bullshit. The reality was quite a bit different. I think the whole idea of putting an Iraqi face on the war was garbage. If you want to win a war, you go in and win it. Then you can train people. Doing it in the middle of a battle is stupid. It was a miracle it didn't fuck things up any worse than it did. Cop Iron. The thin dust from the dirt roads mixed with the stench of the river and city as we came up into the village. It was pitch black, somewhere between night and morning. Our target was a two-story building in the center of a small village at the south side of Ramadi, separated from the main part of the city by a set of railroad tracks. We moved into the house quickly. The people who lived there were shocked, obviously, and clearly wary. Yet they didn't seem overly antagonistic, despite the hour. While our Terps and Jundies dealt with them, I went up to the roof and set up. It was June 17, the start of the action in Ramadi. We had just taken the core of what would become Cop Iron, the first stepping stone of our move into Ramadi. COP stands for Command Observation Post. I eyed the village carefully. We'd been briefed to expect a hell of a fight, and everything we'd been through over the past few weeks in the East reinforced that. I knew Ramadi was going to be a hell of a lot worse than the countryside. I was tense but ready. With the house and nearby area secured, we called the army in. Hearing the tanks coming in the distance, I scanned even more carefully through the scope. The bad guys could hear it too. They'd be here any second. The army arrived with what looked like a million tanks. They took over the nearby houses and then began building walls to form a compound around them. No insurgents came. Taking the house, taking the village, it was a non-event. Looking around, I realized the area we had taken was both literally and figuratively on the other side of the tracks from the main city. Our area was where the poorer people lived. Quite a statement for Iraq, which wasn't exactly the Gold Coast. The owners and inhabitants of the hovels around us barely scratched out a living. They couldn't care less about the insurgency. They couldn't care even less about us. Once the army got settled, we bumped out about 200 yards to protect the crews as they worked. We were still expecting a hell of a fight, but there wasn't much action at all. The only interesting moment came in the morning when a mentally handicapped kid was caught wandering around writing in a notebook. He looked like a spy, but we quickly realized he wasn't right in the head and let him and his gibberish notes go by. We were all surprised by the calm. By noon we were sitting there twiddling our thumbs. I wouldn't say we were disappointed, but it felt like a letdown after what we had been told. This was the most dangerous city in Iraq? 10. The Devil of Ramadi. Going in. A few nights later, I climbed into a shallow Marine Corps riverboat known as a Cirque, small unit riverine craft, ducking down onto the deck behind the armored gunwale. The Marines man in 60s near the bow kept watch as the boat and a second one with the rest of our group slipped upriver, heading quietly toward our insertion point. Insurgent spies hid near the bridges and in various spots in the city. Had we been on land, they would have tracked our progress, but on the water, they weren't an immediate threat, and they didn't pay much attention. We were traveling heavy. Our next stop was near the center of the city, deep in enemy territory. Our boats eased up onto shore, running right up onto the bank of the canal. I rose and walked across the little bow doors, nearly losing my balance as I stepped off onto land. I trotted up the dry land, then stopped and waited for the rest of the platoon to rally around me. We'd taken 8 Iraqis with us in the boats. Counting our Terps, we were just over 24 strong. The Marines slid back into the water and were gone. Taking point, I started moving up the street toward our target. Small houses loomed ahead. There were alleys and wider roads, a maze of buildings, and the shadows of larger structures. I hadn't gotten very far when the laser on my rifle crapped out. The battery had died. I halted our advance. "What the hell's going on?" asked my lieutenant, coming up quickly. "I need to change out my battery real quick," I explained. "Without the laser, I would be aiming blind, little better than not aiming at all." "No, get us out of here." "All right." So I started walking again, taking us up to a nearby intersection. A figure appeared in the darkness ahead, along the edge of a shallow drainage canal. I caught the shadow of his weapon, stared for a moment as I made out the details. AK-47, extra mag taped to one in the rifle. Mooj. The enemy. His back was turned, and he was watching the street rather than the water. But he was well-armed and ready for a fight. Without the laser, I would have been shooting blind. I motioned to my lieutenant. He came up quick, right behind me, and boom! He took down the insurgent. He also damn near put a hole in my eardrum, blasting a few inches from my head. There was no time to bitch. I ran forward as the Iraqi fell, unsure whether he was dead or if there were others nearby. The entire platoon followed, spreading out and busting the corners. The guy was dead. I grabbed his AK. We ran up the street to the house we were going to take, passing some smaller houses on the way. We were a few hundred yards from the river, just off two main roads that would control that corner of the city. Like many Iraqi houses, our target had a wall around it approximately 6 feet tall. The gate was locked, so I slung my M4 on my shoulder, took out my pistol, and hauled up onto the wall, climbing up with one free hand. When I got to the top, I saw there were people sleeping in the courtyard. I dropped down inside their compound, holding my gun on them, expecting one of my platoon mates to come over after me to open the gate. I waited. And waited. And waited. "Come on," I hissed. "Get over here." Nothing. "Come on." Some of the Iraqis started to stir. I eased toward the gate, knowing I was all alone. Here I was, holding a pistol on a dozen insurgents for all I knew, and separated from the rest of my boys by a thick wall and locked gate. I found the gate and managed to jimmy it open. The platoon and our Iraqi jundis ran in, surrounding the people who'd been sleeping in the courtyard. There'd been a mix-up outside, and for some reason they hadn't realized I was in there alone. The people sleeping in the courtyard turned out to be just a regular extended family. Some of my guys got them situated without firing any shots, rounding them up and moving them to a safe area. Meanwhile, the rest of us ran into the buildings, clearing each room as quickly as we could. There was a main building, and then a smaller cottage nearby. While my boys checked for weapons and bombs, anything suspicious, I raced to the rooftop. One of the reasons we'd selected the building was its height. The main structure was 3 stories tall, so I had a decent view of the surrounding area. Nothing stirred. So far, so good. "Building secure," the comm guy radioed to the army. "Come on in." We had just taken the house that would become Cop Falcon, and once more, done so without a fight. Petty Officer Planner. Our head shed had helped plan the Cop Falcon operation, working directly with the Army commanders. Once they were done, they came to the platoon leadership and asked for our input. I got involved in the tactical planning process more deeply than I ever had before. I had mixed feelings. On the one hand, I had experience and knowledge to add something useful. On the other hand, it got me doing the kind of work I don't like to do. It seemed a little admin or bureaucratic. Coat-and-tie stuff, to use a civilian workplace metaphor. As an E6, I was one of the more senior guys in the platoon. Usually you have a chief petty officer, E7, who's the senior enlisted guy, and an LPO, the lead petty officer. Generally, the LPO is an E6, and the only one in the platoon. In our platoon, we had two. I was the junior E6, which was great. Jay, the other E6, was LPO, and so I missed a lot of the admin duties that go with that post. On the other hand, I had the benefits of the rank. For me, it was kind of like the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. I was too senior to do the bullshit jobs and too junior to do the political jobs. I was just right. I hated sitting down at a computer and mapping everything out, let alone making a slideshow presentation out of it. I would have much rather just said, "Hey, follow me. I'll show what we're going to do on the fly." But writing it all down was important. If I went down, someone else would have to be able to step in and know what was going on. I did get stuck with one admin job that had nothing to do with mission planning, evaluating the E-5s. I truly hated it. Jay arranged some sort of trip and left me with that. I'm sure because he didn't want to do it either. The bright side was that I realized how good our people were. There were absolutely no turds in that platoon. It was a real outstanding group. Aside from my rank and experience, the headshed wanted me involved in planning because snipers were taking a more aggressive role in battle. We had become, in military terms, a force multiplier, able to do a lot more than you might think based on our sheer numbers alone. Most planning decisions involved details like the best houses to take for overwatch, the route to take in, how we'd be dropped off, what we would do after the initial houses were taken, etc. Some of the decisions could be very subtle. How you get to a sniper hide, for example. The preference would be to get there as stealthily as possible. That might suggest walking in, as we had in some of the villages. But you don't want to walk through narrow alleys where there's a lot of trash, too much noise, too many chances for an IED or an ambush. There's a misperception among the general public that Spec Ops troops always parachute or fast rope into a trouble zone. While we certainly do both where appropriate, we didn't fly into any of the areas in Ramadi. Helicopters do have certain advantages, speed and the ability to travel relatively long distance being one of them. But they're also loud and attract attention in an urban environment, and they're relatively easy targets to shoot down. In this case, coming in by water made a great deal of sense, because of the way Ramadi is laid out and where the target was located. It allowed us to get to a spot near the target area stealthily, comparatively quickly, and with less chance of contact than the overland routes. But that decision led to an unexpected problem. We had no boats. Ordinarily, SEALs work with special boat teams, known at the time and in the past as special boat units, or SBUs. Same mission, different name. They drive the fast boats that insert SEALs and then retrieve them. We were rescued by one when we were lost on the California coast during training. There was a bit of friction between SEALs and SBUs back home in the bars, where you'd occasionally hear some SBU members claiming to be SEALs. Team guys would think and sometimes say, "That's like a taxi driver claiming to be a movie star because he drove someone to the studio." Whatever. There are some damn good guys out there. The last thing we need is to be picking fights with the people who are supporting us. But that's a point that works both ways. Our problem in Ramadi came from the fact the unit that was supposed to be working with us refused to help. They told us they were too important to be working with us. In fact, they claimed to be standing by for a unit with a higher priority, just in case they were needed, which they weren't. Hey, sorry, I'm pretty sure their job was to help whoever needed it, but whatever. We hunted around and found a Marine unit that was equipped with circ boats, small shallow draft vessels that could get right up to the shore. They were armored and equipped with machine guns, fore and aft. The guys driving them were badass. They did everything an SBU was supposed to do, except that they did it for us. They knew their mission. They didn't pretend to be someone else. They just wanted to get us there the safest way possible. And when our mission was done, they came for us, even if it was a hot extract. These Marines would come in a heartbeat. Cop Falcon. The Army rolled in with tanks, armored vehicles, and trucks. Soldiers humped sandbags and reinforced weak spots in the house. The house we were on was at the corner of a T-intersection of two major roads, one of which we called Sunset. The Army wanted the spot because of its strategic location. It was a choke point and a pretty clear presence inside the city. Those factors also made it a prime target. The tanks drew attention right away. A couple of insurgents began moving toward the house as they arrived. The bad guys were armed with AKs, maybe foolishly thinking they could scare the armor off. I waited until they were 200 yards from the tanks before picking them off. They were easy shots, nailed before they could coordinate an organized attack. A few hours passed. I kept finding shots. The insurgents were probing the area, one or two at a time, trying to sneak in behind us. It was never hot and heavy, but there was a steady stream of opportunity. Pop shots, I called them later. The Army commander estimated we got 24 insurgents in the first 12 hours of the fight. I don't know how accurate that is, but I did take down a few myself that first day, each with one shot. It wasn't particularly great shooting. They were all around 400 yards and less. The 300 Win Mag is a hard hitter at that range. While it was still dark, the Army now had enough defenses at Falcon to hold their own if they were attacked. I went down off the roof and with my boys moved out again, running toward a run-down apartment building a few hundred yards away. The building, one of the tallest around, had a good vantage not only on Falcon but on the rest of the area. We called it four-story. It would end up being a home away from home for much of the battle that followed. We got in without trouble. It was empty. We didn't see much for the rest of the night, but when the sun came up, so did the bad guys. They targeted Cop Falcon, but ineptly. They'd walk, drive, ride mopeds, trying to get close enough to launch an attack. It was always obvious what they were doing. You'd see a couple of guys on a moped. The first would have an AK, and the second would have a grenade launcher. I mean, come on. We started getting a lot of shots. Four-story was a great sniper hide. It was the tallest building around, and you couldn't get close enough to shoot at it without exposing yourself. It was easy to pick an attacker off. Dauber says we took 23 guys in the first 24 hours we were there. In the days that followed, we'd get plenty more targets. Of course, after the first shot, it was a fighting position, not a sniper hide. But in a way, I didn't mind being attacked. The insurgents were just making it easier for me to kill them. Numbers 100 and 101. If the action around Cop Iron had been dull to none, action around Cop Falcon was the exact opposite, intense and thick. The Army camp was a clear threat to the insurgents, and they wanted it gone. A flood of bad guys came at us. That only made it easier for us to defeat them. Very shortly after Ramadi started, I reached a huge milestone for a sniper. I got my 100th and my 101st confirmed kills for that deployment. One of the guys took a photo of me for posterity, holding up the brass. There was a little bit of a competition between myself and some of the other snipers during this deployment to see who got the most kills. Not that we all had that much to do with the numbers. They were more a product of how many targets we had to shoot at. It's just the luck of the draw. You want to have the highest numbers, but there's not much you can do about it. I did want to be the top sniper. At first, there were three of us who had the most kills, then two of us started pulling away. My competition was in my sister platoon working on the east side of the city. His total shot up at one point, pulling ahead. Our big boss man happened to be on our side of the city, and he was keeping track of how the platoons were doing. As part of that, he had the sniper totals. He tweaked me a little as the other sniper pulled in front. "He's gonna break your record," he'd tease. "You better get on that gun more." Well, things evened out real fast. All of a sudden, I seemed to have every stinking bad guy in the city running across my scope. My total shot up, and there was no catching me. Luck of the draw. If you're interested, the confirmed kills were only kills that someone else witnessed, and cases where the enemy could be confirmed dead. So if I shot someone in the stomach and he managed to crawl around where we couldn't see him before he bled out, he didn't count.
The Cows. We will be picking up next week on page 463 for me. We are in chapter 10, and it's the subheading, Working with the Army. I'm still not sure about the number of sessions left. It looks like it could be two because we've been doing close to 100 pages per week. We've been clicking along, but at least two of these left. So we'll be back next week with more of American Sniper. Anywho, for folks who would like to chime in, the number to dial is 760-569-7676. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All of the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free, chime in. We have roughly a half hour left in the program.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, you know, I must say, I love this book, man. It's excellent and revealing. Man, more savages, slaughtering savages. I mean, this guy is way past his amount of killed. All of a sudden, these guys got drones. I mean, they just, it's just like a video game or kind of like a book or a movie. And then more homoerotic talk. We reamed him out. Or a phone call. It seems like they're just, you know, the people they're fighting against are trying to defend themselves. Like, you know, you're going from house to house just slaughtering people, and they're trying to defend themselves, and you're calling them insurgents. And, you know, the revealing part to me, man, that, the other night, I just listened to this, so I wrote you earlier, that racist white Zionist Jewish female you had on from Princeton and went to school in the Bronx and raised her kids on the Upper East Side, but somehow had a British accent. He said you could put an Iraqi face on the war, but you know, they ain't really in charge. And she kept saying, "Oh, isn't the president black and the chancellor is black?" I mean, you know, like, come on, you can't be that foolish. And I'm glad he put that in his book. Oh, man, that was just great. And the Jundies, they call them Jundies or whatever they call it, man. It's like niggers, like they're lazy. They don't want to give them the tools, the progress. Oh, man, I love this book. Oh, man, they took over areas and just put fences around them. And what's funny to me, it was like they went to the worst city in Iraq because it was the poorest city in Iraq. And they ain't getting no resistance. It was like, you know, they expecting to get all this resistance. These people were nice. Just come in. Because what did they have to fight for? I mean, they were already oppressed. Me personally, and I hate to say it, if the United States has someone attacking them here, I don't feel compelled to help them. I'm sorry. I know it's soldiers on the phone and stuff, but I mean, listen, it can't be any worse than what we got. That's how I look at it. And that's all I have to say.
This is Scotty from North Carolina. I do not consider myself a soldier, although I was in the military, and I try to discourage people from going into the military if all possible. So I was a misguided youth, but I don't take any offense to anything you say like that, and I concur with that. And Immortal Technique actually had a record out. What was it? George Bush. What was it? I can't remember the name of it, but he has a line in there that if America is invaded, he wouldn't be fighting to save America. He'd be fighting to protect the hood. And so that's kind of similar sentiments. I had taken notes, and the same things that you had mentioned, I picked up on that too. Calling them lazy. They did not want to fight. Well, why should they fight? It's not their war. They didn't start the war. Why should they fight? You know, but the typical language that's used towards particularly black people, non-white people here in the United States, lazy Mexicans, lazy Negroes, same kind of language. I also have wrote down proxies. The Jundis were being used as proxies to put Iraqi face on white supremacy. And I particularly, and I'm like, okay, they're using, what this book also shows is how they're deploying military tactics right here in the United States. Well, of course, many of these cops are former soldiers, okay? You know, they've been militarized. And then when the first thing that came to my mind when it was like, put an Iraqi face on it, I thought about Ferguson and Captain Ron Johnson. Okay, let's put a black face as being in charge, you know, of the Ferguson put down. We're going to, you know, suppress all of these Negroes out here trying to exercise their First Amendment rights. And I picked up on that. Again, a lot of propaganda about Saddam Hussein. I don't know what the average, what would we say, medium income of an Iraqi would be or what their standard of living would be, but I had done some reading and research, and it was pretty peaceful and calm in Iraq outside of the fights that they were having with Iran, which was fueled by the United States, and with the Kurds. Other than that, from what I could gather is that, you know, the Iraqis weren't exactly living in poverty. Again, I would have to do more research, but the language, like, they were living in the stone ages. And then another one, did not know how to handle freedom. Now, I heard this racist suspect who is an aide to the congressman that represents my district, and I had called him on the phone trying to talk to the congressman. And I'm purposely saying my congressman, because he's not my congressman, but he's over this district. But I wanted to talk to him about the 13th Amendment and the kind of discrepancy that the North Carolina Constitution has with the U.S. Constitution. And so then I was telling him, I was talking to this aide, and I was talking about, you know, is it right to be locking up all of these people for nonviolent so-called victimless crimes? That doesn't seem right to me. And he told me that, well, we got a lot of freedom here in the United States, and a lot of people don't know how to handle that freedom. Now, think about that, what that indicates. You know, that means if we got so much freedom, and I'm not, you know, suggesting anybody use drugs or anything like that, but why can't an adult have the freedom to use any kind of drug he wants to, you know, as long as he's not harming anyone else and forcibly, you know, shoving needles up somebody's arm? But that really stood out to me. Like, you know, like, we don't know how to handle freedom. Non-white people are not used to being free, and we don't know how to handle freedom. And again, the Stone Ages comments, and they really destroyed these countries, man, bombed all their infrastructure, bombed them back into the quote-unquote Stone Ages. The other one, now he want to talk about people being lazy, but then, you know, he talks about how he didn't want to work in administrative work. He didn't want to sit behind a computer. He didn't want to do, you know, the paperwork and things that what he called the suit and tie duties. And so that just told me right then and there, you know, this guy probably has a very low IQ, and, you know, they test you when you go in the military to see what part of the military or what job you will get. And I'm willing to bet this guy scored very low on the ASVAB test, you know, and that's probably the only thing he was good at was being an attack dog and killing people. Quickly, last thing, corruption. He won't talk about all the corruption in Iraq, but pallets of money, billions of dollars went missing in Iraq that the Bush administration sent over there to just hand out all this money, I guess, to buy people off, pacify people, whatever. But a lot of that money was stolen by United States contractors. Again, talking about corruption, I'm again reminded of Lavina Johnson, all the females that I've seen testify and tell their stories about being raped, hearing about all the people that have been killed, you know, after being raped. Just let's call it soldier on soldier crime, you know. So and then who can forget Abu Ghraib, you know, where we've all seen the pictures, and now more stories are coming out how they were raping young male Iraqi boys in front of their mothers. So just chock full of pro-American propaganda. And I'll mute my line.
Other folks who had hands up have comments they want to make sure they got in? Everybody else who had a hand up, line should be open.
This is kind of off topic, but I was listening to Democracy Now! During the week, and they were talking about this Mauritanian man who was raped by the women in the Guantanamo Bay. So that's what Mr. Scotty Reed reminded me of, that report I heard.
The other folks who had hands up have comments they wanted to get in as well. Everybody who had a hand up, line should be open.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just failed to mention something that I wanted to say earlier. Earlier in the book, he mentioned Jessica Litch. That was supposed to have been a young white female that was fighting furiously when she was captured by the Iraqis and held and tortured and all of this stuff. And then they came in and rescued her later. Come to find out that, you know, none of her story was true. She went on and admitted that she didn't even fire a bullet. You know, she was treated well. Some doctors or something hit her out of it. The soldiers found it. But they failed to mention the first black female prisoner of war was Shoshana Johnson. And I remember even during that time when that Jessica Lynch story came out, they failed to mention about the black female that also was captured and her and five other members, I think, of his unit. But it just goes to show that, you know, black lives, you know, doesn't matter in their mind, and it's always putting the white team up front. And it was Phil Sherman Jones. I mean,
other folks had a hand up, have anything they wanted to make sure they got in? Anybody we hadn't heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How's it going? My name's Chris. First-time caller. Listening for about a year and a half now. And this is my first audiobook that I've actually tuned in for. And I have to say that I'm very shocked at how candid it is and honest, you know, as far as it, him being such a foot soldier and willingly killing these people and admitting to it, you know, and having such blatant racist views. It seems as though this was not read over, or maybe the U.S. military just doesn't care. You would think a lot of this would be redacted, you know, to have a much sunnier disposition, but this is a very brutal, cunning, and just despicable read, and it's chilling at how much what it means to be white being vicious. You know, it's I'm shocked for real. But you know, it's that's it. That's all I have right now.
I know. That doesn't translate to the film for folks. I think most people grasp, you know, more people are going to watch television or movies than actually sitting down to read the book. Even I think some of the people that have come out, either yay or either they're for or against the film, have admitted when they're doing all this that they have not read the book. But that being said, I do think that the typical white person reading this book, they would not empathize with the savages in Iraq, so they wouldn't. This is not something that they would read and think, "Oh my God, this guy's a barbarian and a psycho." But they wouldn't think that at all. It would just be like, you know, he's this guy's bad. This guy is tough. He is a warrior, and he's going over and doing it. Like, yeah, like he's Rambo or John Wayne. You know, this guy is a patriot. Like, he went over there and fought to protect our freedoms and, you know, to make sure that we can preserve our democracy. And I think that's the way they would read it. It wouldn't be, you know, this guy is a killer. This guy has some mental issues, and he is the savage. The way that I just don't think they would process it that way at all. And I think they have been so effective that a lot of non-white people wouldn't read it that way either. And just there's no empathy for non-white people in the way that we've been conditioned to think about non-white people on the whole, and certainly quote unquote Iraqis and the Middle East people are just not gonna process it in a manner that when he's saying I loved killing and it was fun and I wanted to go back and do it, that this guy is the ultimate warrior. What he's doing, that I think that's just the way. Even if you look at the billboard, some of the movie for the film, where it's got him and he's got his gun and his military garb and it's got the American flag fluttering. This is patriotism. This is somebody that's going out and defending the American way of life. So yeah, I think that's one where you would have to be a little bit less confused to catch what you're, in my opinion, your accurate understanding of the text. Any of the other folks on? Did we miss anybody? Make sure. If you had a hand up, did we miss anybody? Got everybody who dialed in. Yeah, I thought it was very important, the putting an Iraqi face on all of this, the racial showcasing that has been a tried and true technique for whites consistently. That's one of, just wow. they know that will get them a lot of mileage in making it look like it is not whites who are in charge, who are running the show. We will make it look like it is these other non-white people who are up here, but that is not the case. You should already, it's great to have a white person explaining that that's what they were doing here. Most of the time you don't get it that explicitly. But I think that should be the default understanding, as long as that's what white supremacy means. If that exists, then you cannot be a non-white person, quote unquote, in charge. That does not compute at all if white supremacy exists and is a worldwide problem phenomenon. The Jumdies, exactly as you all called it. I would even say, just to have that in mind, I think Thomas in New York had said that whenever they say savages, you should think nigger. When we had Miss Patton on the program yesterday, and she was talking about the name calling when the white educator in New York was calling a black parent coordinator, calling her a nigger. That's the way you should process it. And that's why, in my opinion, that is terrorism, whether you're using her definition, the definition that's in the Word Guide, the United States definition for terrorism. All of that is the same thing. It is about intimidation, fear, and it's directly or indirectly connected to violence. There's a long history. This came up yesterday about what has traditionally been associated with, hey, calling someone a nigger or being classified as a nigger. That means we can subject you to anything. And that's the exact same logic that you see played out in this book. These savages, these Jundies. I'm not here to educate. I'm here to kill. Like, just make it plain. That's why I said at the beginning, that this is one of the easiest books that we have ever done, for the book club. Like, I feel like you just play, read, and it's very clear. You get all of white thought, white logic, white culture, the violence, the pathology, all of it. It's right there. White people kill for fun, and he just lays it out very clean. I would have never read this book or have even been interested in reading this book prior to being a little bit less confused about racism. But I think this sort of text, this is when Mr. Fuller, when he says, we need to study whites. We do not understand whites and why we continue to have this problem. This is a phenomenal book to study. I would definitely recommend. I'm glad we have invested the time. Folks have anything else they want to make sure they got in? We have about 5 minutes or so left.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I have a question, and I don't want to be, I don't know if this has come from confusion, but as I see it, everyone else sits at the table of white supremacy when it comes to other
races and other things like that. So, because they all are in agreement of treating blacks like whites do, you know, Arabs, you know, everyone else but us. I'm surprised that they are, the Arabs are allowing themselves to be demonized in this fashion with this movie, with the book, without much, without heavy, you know, pushback or any type of, I mean, honestly, an upsurge in violence, you know, because we're the only ones, they react appropriately to oppression and disrespect, whereas, you know, we do not. I'm surprised that they are reacting how we would, which is basically taking it on the chin. What are your thoughts?
Well, that, particularly the last portion, that very consistent in saying black people just take it on the chin and don't fight back, that is not accurate. I've said that before. People that have been listening to the program, that is monumentally disrespectful to black ancestors, whether it's Robert F. Williams, and frequently it's not because there aren't a long list of black people who have whatever you think would be an appropriate response up to and including killing whites. That has been done. Large numbers of black people have done that and continue to do that. I like to point to examples that have happened in the last 5 years. Lavelle Mixon, Nkosi Thondaway, Maurice Clemens. There are tons of these people that have done exactly that. Just
in the United States.
Exactly. It's tons of them who have done that. So that should never be said. It is not true. And it is monumentally disrespectful to black, not just black ancestors, but black people that are still alive right now. And Nkosi Thondaway is alive right now. And he killed white people and said when he went to trial, it was because of racism and what white people have done to us. So that part notwithstanding, I don't know. I haven't heard any of the folks that, you know, if they're quote-unquote Iraqis that are living here in the States now or folks that are living in that area of the world, what their thoughts are on the book or the film or how all of this has come out. I don't know if they, you know, what their thoughts are about this and what have you. That would be interesting to hear some of their comments about this film coming out. I would simply say, under the system of racism, white supremacy, this happens to all non-white people. I mean, the same thing with The Interview. Non-white people get this sort of demeaning treatment all the time. White people do this sort of thing to just make it known how they view everybody that is not classified as white, that you can be subjected to any sort of mistreatment, abuse, up to and including killing large numbers of individuals. So I don't know if folks know about, you know, individuals who are classified as Iraqis, if they have thoughts on this, the text, the book, the film, if they have thoughts on it, if you've seen that, if there are links or information online, that would be good to see, but I don't know about that.
Well, Gus, let me ask you one final question. I guess what I was saying in regards to a black response to white supremacy is that even though, you know, there has been a resistance, that isn't the response as a group historically and consistently, because I have to believe that if we responded appropriately every time, you and I wouldn't have inherited this system of white supremacy.
I mean,
as a group,
white supremacy, the black people, non-white people in total, there have been tons of incidents of large numbers of black people being involved in all kinds of counter responses, including violence and saying we're going to try to kill white people, large numbers of white people. White supremacy has thus far proven we can handle any of these challenges so far. I don't think that will be the case permanently, but thus far they have flexed their supremacy and put down all of these attacks. Now, hopefully we can, you know, get a better understanding of what's happening and continue our efforts. But I mean, there are tons of, I would even say this program, folks participating in this, this is a form of resistance. This does feel like a deviation from the book, a tad, off into our response. But this right here is a response. I would absolutely agree that thus far our response hasn't been adequate because we haven't solved this problem. But
here, here.
I definitely think that there is, I mean, it's tons of evidence. We will shoot back. We had the guest on the program talking about that with Dr. Emoja. That nonviolent stuff will get you killed. We had Dr. Cobb on the program talking about that. It's tons of black. It's more black people than I even have time to name right now that have any type of, I mean, even if you're just talking about violence and saying, hey, this is war and we need to respond appropriately, that has been done. Continues to be done.
Meagan Fuller says that we may have won battles, but we lose the war.
I think when you're looking at the United States, you have to figure into the equation that we are outnumbered, outgunned, and behind enemy lines. So, I mean, we just do the best we can. I mean, the right. fact that we are still alive, you know, suggests that, you know, we have resisted and resisted successfully to the point that we're surviving and we're still reproducing. And not been wiped out, totally. And, I mean, there could be different reasons for why they wouldn't want to wipe us out because they need us for slave labor. But, and if we want to go outside of the United States, I mean, Africa, pretty much has, you know, fought for its independence and won in a number of countries. Now we know that, you know, through the World Bank and through other, mostly financial instruments of oppression, that they pretty much being colonized again. So I would say globally, of course, the problem hasn't been solved, but there have been, much, resistance. I mean, we can look at Haiti. Even though they're being recolonized now, but they were successful in defeating one of the most powerful European armies on the face of the planet at that time. And so, yeah, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, I guess for me, just for accuracy, I don't want it to be.
Hang on, because this is a deviation. This is not American Sniper. This is, we can bring this up tomorrow or at other times, but this is not on the book. Did anybody have anything else they wanted to get in about the book before we wrap up?
Oh, I did have one other thing, and this goes back to the use of savages and dehumanizing language. And again, I didn't encounter a lot of this language, and it was a different war, Gulf War. But I did keep up with this particular, war, whatever you want to call it, attack, assault, occupation. But I recall, this, black Muslim U.S. soldier attacked and killed his commander because they were using that kind of dehumanizing language all the time, and he just wasn't going to have it. And so, again, that just lends me to believe that this is standard protocol for the training of combat troops, is to always refer to the people you want to kill as anything, you know, but human. And so that came into my mind, and I had forgotten to mention that. But I wonder if anybody recalls that. That black Muslim U.S. Army soldier killing his white commanders, threw a grenade in a tent because they were always referring to Muslims as ragheads and sand monkeys and other kind of stuff. So that came to mind.
I heard about that. They said that he was the one that they were messing with. They were messing with him, and it was a retaliation. So you don't think it was personal attacks toward him, or it was just
both possible.
Both. Okay. Just make sure that. Okay. Yeah, I think the last thing I heard about him is he was charged with life or something like that. But I haven't heard anything else.
Chris Kyle said that on an interview before he was died. I don't remember if it was the one that was on Conan O'Brien or Bill O'Reilly, but I mean, it was huge. It was something where a lot of people would have seen this, and no, there was no outrage, or I mean, it was an audience that was listening to him, and it wasn't like, you know, it was people in the crowd going, "Oh my gosh, how would he just say that? That you can't think of them as humans, the people that you're fighting." And it was like, "Huh, okay, next." So I think whites understand that logic, and as has been said already, they function off that same logic anyway. That's why you have all of these depictions. Officer in San Diego just this week, where they were comparing him to a monkey, same thing that they were doing to President Obama and Michelle Obama, same thing with Michael Brown, where he's a pavement. They understand that logic. So I don't think this is anomalous. I think this is standard operating procedure for whites, not just in combat situations. I'm sure it's probably just intensified there, but this is just common everyday practice for whites, period, in the way that they function, the way that they talk about and think about non-whites. We are not humans. We're not human beings, and we will behave accordingly, and that's why you have all of these that's why we continue to have all these problems in all areas of people activity. But definitely I would encourage folks to check out the not so much the film. The film, I think that's only, you know, once you've read the book, you can check out the film. I think you can get more from it from a comparison contrast, but I definitely would encourage the book if you want to get some information about what does it mean to be white. I ask that question rhetorically all the time. I would. This book is phenomenal. We still have about 200, or maybe a little less than 200 pages to go, but we should have at least two left, maybe three, because about 200 pages, or a little less than 200 pages left. Go ahead,
Miss Patton. Miss Patton comes to mind. Again, I mean, like I had mentioned earlier, and of course, others way before me, others have done work. But I mean, it is standard SOP in American media, whether that be news media, whether that be movies and whatnot. But going back to Miss Patton, you know, that blacks commit the most violent crimes. And where did she get that from? Her television, watching the news. And so, yeah, it is standard operating procedure for white people.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
May I be heard? I got a quick thing, Gus, if you got a second.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a link to the movie if anybody's interested in it. I can forward it to you, Gus, and you can push it out. I haven't watched it yet, but, you know, if anybody's interested in seeing it, kind of seeing what it's all about, I could do that if you're interested, Gus.
Is it this movie, American Sniper, this one?
Yes, I have a link to the movie American Sniper, and I can email it to you. Like.
Oh, sure. I already have that, but yeah, you can send it to
me. Okay.
If you want to send it to me, I can just put it on my Facebook in case there are other people that are listening if they want to watch it. Untiljustice@gmail.com, and I'll put it on my Facebook page so if folks want to, you know, check it out.
We'll just make sure I blast that.
I'm sorry?
I'll send that tonight.
Make sure.
You said, oh, you just wanted to see it?
Yes, let's make sure why I blast that. Yeah, put it on your Facebook, and I'll make sure I push it on mine, too.
Oh, okay. Right on. Yeah, don't pay for it. Don't go to the movies, even Netflix or anything like that. Definitely make sure you get it for free to check it out for study purposes, just to come back. Because, like I said, if you've been following with the study sessions, it's a lot of stuff that they did not include in the movie, just if you want to do a comparison. I mean, that's always happens. I mean, you can only do so much for 2 hours, but I mean, it's like, wow. Like, this is a totally different presentation if you don't read the book and you just watch the movie. You lose a lot of the insight and the detail about what it means to be white if you watch the movie, what Clint Eastwood and company have delivered. But yes, I will share so folks can check that out. We will be back tomorrow. You should be reading the news too. If folks that are following along in this and, you know, you feel like it's constructive, you're learning something, you should check the news because it's just reams of stuff almost every day about this movie. More people coming out and saying, you know, they don't like, it's propaganda. A lot of the things that we have touched on, people making those comments saying that it's racist, and it's just glorification of this white guy, this white killer going and killing non-white people. I posted the article that Rania Kalik, I hope I'm saying her name correctly, that she wrote. Again, she was a guest on KPFK earlier this week, Uprising Radio, and she was with Scott McCune, who's one of the co-authors. She was both co-authors. She was giving her view, and obviously they did not agree since they wrote the book, but it was that. You can check the Times-Picayune. They had a great report today. It's been so much material about this film. It's really a great opportunity where you can learn a lot of information, and it should present you some opportunities to get dialogue. I'd say pay attention when you're around other whites. If they're talking about this movie, if they've seen it, what they have to say, you can learn a lot. But we'll be back tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We should have a lot. I think the schedule, at least for right now, if I'm remembering correctly, we should have a black female on the program
On Monday, she was talking about being frustrated with having to suppress her feelings when she is around whites. I think a lot of people can relate to that. We should have a black male on the program on Wednesday. He'd been talking a lot about Charlie Hebdo and how this was just reaffirming white power. And white's ability to be racist and say racist things. He had written several reports. He should be with us on Wednesday. On Thursday, the white woman I was telling you about who was supposed to be here this past week, she writes for the New York Times ostensibly about how to talk to white people, how white people should talk to their white children about racism so that their white children are not racist, right? That's ostensibly what she's writing. It's in the New York Times. You can check. She has a lot of columns. It's like a regular weekly or several times a month thing, but she should be here on Thursday. So we should be here next week, Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. But we'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you get confused, if you have questions, feel free, drop an email. We can get you hopefully cleared up if you have confusion. If you are not able to participate live and you just want to email your observations or thoughts about the book study session, you can do that too, and I will share on the program untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, it is the weekend. I would encourage remain codified. It's one of the worst decisions that you can make to be under the influence and get behind the wheel. Whites are out. They are looking to make a mess of your life. You're not going to get the Chris Kyle treatment where they follow you home and give you a thumbs up and wish you the best. That's not going to happen if you are a black person. So sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. If you can't do that, at minimum, codify, get to one spot and stay there so that you do not have the misfortune of being under the influence and then in contact with Darren Wilson, Daniel Pantaleo, Daniel Holtzclaw et al. We will be back tomorrow. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to constantly demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect, each area of people activity, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. Constructive activity, always, always, always. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of white supremacy, signing out.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.